A thousand years after the death of Christ, money changers, those who loan out and manipulate the quantity of money, were active in medieval England. In fact, they were so active that acting together, they could manipulate the entire English economy. These were not bankers per se. The money changers generally were the goldsmiths. They were the first bankers because they started keeping other people's gold for safekeeping in their vaults. The first paper money was merely a receipt for gold left at the goldsmith. Paper money caught on because it was more convenient than carrying around a lot of heavy gold and silver coins. Eventually, goldsmiths noticed that only a small fraction of the depositors ever came in and demanded their gold at any one time. Goldsmiths started cheating on the system. They discovered that they could print more money than they had gold, and usually no one would be the wiser.
Then they could loan out this extra money and collect interest on it. This was the birth of fractional reserve banking, that is, loaning out many times more money than you have assets on deposit. So, if $1,000 in gold were deposited with them, they could loan out about $10,000 in paper money and draw interest payments on it, and no one would ever discover the deception.
It's Friday. The mulled wine is in the coffee maker. It's 5 o'clock, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday the 16th of December 2022, streaming live from the PRSC Arts Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available from all good app stores. Not please Google. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade Ukraine psyops, and smearing cheap COVID treatment, as Dr. Tess Laurie told us on this very show. The TV lied and an estimated 60,000 Brits died. Matt Hancock's crimes against humanity, followed now by God knows how many more from the poison death jabs. That's the verdict, anyway, of Dr. Zev Zelenko, died recently. He was Trump's doctor. Now, all supposedly forgotten in the Ukraine psyop. Navigating us through the Fourth Reich, that is the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also joining us in the studio this week is Peter Taylor, the author of Chill, A Reassessment of Global Warming. Also this week, we have Anton Chaitkin looking at the Pentecostal movement and how the CIA had a hand in creating it. Well, maybe actually the CIA did it all on their own, eh? And also the reassessment of James Files, this guy who had nothing to do, according to the FBI, the CIA, and all of the entire American media, with the assassination of John F. Kennedy. We hear, a pretty good chunk of him describing how he killed JFK. He was, of course, a hitman, if you haven't heard of him before, for the Chicago Mafia, who was sent down to do the job on the day in Dallas. Also, David Halpin this week. He has prompted me to have a good old look, because we've been looking at the Sizewell decision to go ahead with Sizewell C nuclear power station, on the death of somebody called Hilda Morell. In 1984, she was just about to give evidence at the Sizewell B public inquiry, and she was found dead in her car over in Shropshire. So David Halpin has got a few things to say about her. Also, her nephew, a guy called Robert Green, he also has a lot to say, and he was working for the Royal Navy. He was a commander in the Royal Navy at the same time as all that happened. Plus, here in Bristol, you may have seen the pictures in the newspapers and on the TV of the Bristol sorting offices, with the foxes and the rats running around on your presence, left out in the open air, and being rained on and snowed on, covered with snow, this sort of thing. Well, guess what? The Royal Mail, rather than do something about leaving stuff out in the rain and the cold and exposed to animals for them to sort of chew into your Christmas hamper and this sort of thing, what they've done is they've sacked the guy that talked to the BBC about it from the Communication Workers Union. Well, they haven't actually sacked him, they've suspended him. So we have a chat with Kevin Beezer, who's the regional organiser for the Communication Workers Union in the South West, about what really happened there, and also about the dispute as a whole. Also, where is all the money going that we pay as our rail fares? Nobody talks about this. Absolutely nobody. The Roscoes, they're called, the rolling stock companies that take the billions of pounds of profit from the railways. They are basically banks that own the rolling stock. And what they do is they then lease them to the train operating companies. I'm starting to sound on this program like an evil empire advisory group for if you want to buy shares in evil companies, because these are giving amazing returns. And some of them not even actually operating any trains. They're just sitting there in a desk saying, tick, tick, tick. You've borrowed this train or you've rented it for so long. Pay us this much. And the shareholders take the money. And so I have a chat to a former Assistant General Secretary of the Rail Maritime Transport Union this week, all about the Roscoes, who they are and how much profit they're taking out of the system, which means of course that we pay double and triple and even quadruple the fares that people in other parts of Europe pay for our trains, and also that the government then say, oh, we can't afford to pay the train drivers the level of inflation increase. So you've got all that to look forward to. But we start really with an introduction to our guest today, who is Peter Taylor, hails from Glasgow, and he's just been up doing a talk in Stroud. Peter, hi, welcome to the Politics Show.
Oh, good to be here.
Well, you see, you've done a lot of work on modelling over the years. Can you just talk us through, because this is something which I think many people are very sceptical about, particularly when it comes to COVID and this Mr. Ferguson chap, and also, of course, economic modelling.
Well, yes. Well, I don't know a great deal about economic modelling, but for a good 10 or 15 years of my professional life, I was involved in critiquing models of ocean pollution, models that were used by government laboratories to justify discharging toxic material into the ocean. It would then disperse, and as far as they were concerned, it wouldn't come back. And the computer models were built on that, and then they set up the regulatory regimes, which we would call dilute and disperse. And basically, I was working as an ecologist. I'd set up a small ecological research group in Oxford. And we did work for environmental groups, councils, citizens' initiatives, anyone who was in some way threatened by industrial developments, nuclear in particular. You mentioned Hilda Morell. I knew Hilda Morell personally. So in that time, we had to really learn about the modelling, and I was fortunate enough to be able to work with some highly skilled computer systems analysts and mathematicians, and we were able to critique the models and take that critique to the UN and get certain practices such as dumping nuclear waste in the oceans banned internationally. So,
well, okay, let me stop you there, because that's quite an achievement, really. What is it about your models that convinced them that dumping nuclear waste in the oceans was a bad idea? I mean, obviously, for most of us, we can see it's a bad idea without having to do any modelling at all, You managed to convince them.
At that time, we didn't produce our own models. That came a bit later. What we did was we looked at the assumptions that were going into their models. Then we did the research on actual, from data, as to what was actually happening. So, for example, toxic material was finding its way back through the food chains. And we were able to access the latest data and say, on the floor of the UN, look, sorry, these models are completely wrong. And that was effective. But a bit later, you mentioned Sizewell, for example. We were heavily involved in the Sizewell inquiry. This was Sizewell B, the one that Hilda Morell was due to arrive at. And at that time, we'd actually managed to get our own expertise in modelling, because a lot of the safety protocols for nuclear reactors were actually based on atmospheric dispersion of radioactivity, assuming that they'd had an accident of some kind. And what we said was, well, all your models are assuming that the containment building stays intact. And we knew from engineers that worked for us that actually that was not a completely safe assumption, that things could happen which would blow the containment. And if that happened and you stuck to the normal emergency planning regulations, then you would be sending into that accident area fire brigade, police, emergency services. They would be going into a death zone. And they didn't know that. And we were actually contracted by the fire brigade services union, the police and so forth, to critique the models. And we could then run our own assessment of what would happen if the containment was breached. So we modeled the dispersion of radioactivity and the death zone and fed that into the emergency services unions. And we actually changed the planning. They gave the go-ahead for Sizewell's B, as you know, but the planning rules were changed. Now, unfortunately, that was not communicated internationally to the Russians, for obvious reasons, perhaps in Russia. And everything that we predicted in 1983 happened at Chernobyl. They were the emergency services were sent to their deaths, and they had no idea what they were dealing with. And if you remember the, I think it was Channel 4 documentary, Chernobyl, you've got firemen picking up chunks of graphite and going, "What's this?" And then watching their hands turn red. That man's going to die within a month, very painful death. So that was our early work with models. The models were built on the assumption that containment would not be breached. So we had to model the breaching of the containment in order to change the law. So I had some expertise in modeling, but after our successes on ocean policy, and I think in nuclear, we didn't stop Sizewell B, but we stopped the fast breeder and the fast reactor program and reprocessing of nuclear waste in Germany and Sweden. We were active everywhere. We lost out in France. They went ahead and they built the only fast breeder reactor in Europe. But we stopped it here. I worked for the Scottish Fishermen's Federation.
This is Dún Laoghaire you're talking about.
Dún Laoghaire.
Right, well, that ended up being a disaster in itself, didn't it? I mean, I wonder whether that would have been shut down even without your help.
Well, what we were focusing on were the discharges of plutonium to the sea and working for the Scottish Fishermen's Federation, who objected to that naturally. And so, effectively, by making it more expensive for them, because they had to adhere to much stricter standards, the whole project became uneconomic and was eventually abandoned.
Well, many would say nuclear is uneconomic anyway.
Well, the economics are very well hidden. And in those days, they were saying, well, it's the cheapest form, but actually it wasn't. It's a bit like wind turbines today. They say it's the cheapest form, but actually there are lots of hidden subsidies. But to come on to your original question about modeling, I moved into areas of biodiversity planning, forest strategies, and so forth after our pollution work. I wanted to do something more creative. So I'm actually a specialist in wildlife conservation, and we practically invented rewilding in Britain. The Americans were a bit ahead of us, but a totally different flavor over there. But here, rewilding was very much a community initiative in wild places. And I edited a book 10 years ago where we networked all of those community initiatives. This was before George Monbiot and the let's go for global Britain, big press and kind of glamorizing of it, and it wasn't until much later, after I'd worked for the Countryside Agency on how to integrate renewable energy into the landscape, community biodiversity, that I thought, my goodness, you know, it can't be done. If we try to power an industrial society from renewables, we'll destroy the planet. Not physically, but what would happen is everybody would be living in an electrotechnical landscape. And so,
what do you mean by an electrotechnical landscape?
It means that instead of countryside, you would have turbines everywhere, solar panels, nuclear reactors. Everything would be dedicated to producing. And the thing about renewables is that they're intermittent, so you have to have a backup.
Well, yeah. And a lot of people are saying nuclear has got to be that backup. But yes. we had a former coal miner, someone who's been campaigning for the reopening of this coking coal mine up in Cumbria last week. And he was absolutely extolling the virtues of this carbon capture with coal-fired power stations. So saying that, listen, you know, you don't have to be chucking out all this CO2 from a coal-fired power station. Mm. The technology's there to capture it.
The technology is there, but it's very expensive, and not everywhere has the deep storage facilities. You'd have to have a pipeline system. For
what about China? Do they?
China is busy building coal-fired power stations like there was no tomorrow, and with the agreement of the UN. So the whole of the Kyoto Treaty effectively transferred energy-hungry technologies to China, where it's cheap, where there's little environmental regulation.
Well, it's not just the technologies, it's the energy. You know, the energy being produced is now over there rather than over here.
Yes, and the technology follows that because it they don't have to worry about the regulations. And, of course, all the goods that come out of China are cheap. Your white goods are half the price. So it keeps the Western economy afloat. I mean, China doesn't exist as a country anymore. It's a workhouse for Western capitalism and investment.
Martin, I mean, describing China as a workhouse, I don't think you would probably do that because you see quite a lot of positive aspects in China, don't you?
Well, I mean, the basics of what's going on have just been described. The Chinese obviously want to develop a middle-class society and lifestyle just as we already have. And in theory, there's supposedly, you know, we're supposed to be working together to deal with these common problems. But in practice, there's a great deal of hostility developing between the US and China and Russia. And the, you know, cooperation on these ecological matters is definitely going to take a second fiddle to, you know, war production, if nothing else.
Well, that's right. The Chinese are not necessarily there, but the Russians certainly are. They're beginning to get into a war production mode. Don't you think that the Chinese, for example, Peter, are looking at a lot of this and saying, well, you just want us to curb our coal emissions because you're fighting us?
Well, I'd make a difference between what the Chinese government says for international consumption and what's actually happening. And what's actually happening is there's a massive inflow of capital, especially during the COVID years, into China. So that's international capital, particularly the US, Britain, Europe, possibly Japan, I'm not sure. But the Chinese economy continues to grow, whereas other economies are stalling. So naturally, the investment banks, led particularly by the Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation, they are investing like mad in China. So effectively, the real China is a place where Western capital can make a profit, and that's why there's such an inflow of capital there.
Well, it's not a communist country anymore, Martin, is it? You've got HSBC sitting there thinking, well, actually, we pretty much own you guys now. You better keep working, otherwise we're going to have to foreclose on our loans.
Yeah. Well, the economist Michael Hudson, I don't know if you've come across him, he's a US economist, and he wrote a book, came out in 1972, called Super Imperialism. And he's written a more recent book, because he's quite an old guy now, called, well, I can't remember what it's called.
The Future. It's called The Future of Civilization, Finance Capitalism, Industrial Capitalism, or Socialism.
Or Socialism, that's
mark.
Right. Yeah. So you've got a tension in China between the capitalist roaders, if you like, and those who are, you know, still Marxist-Leninists in their basic orientation. So one simple thing is that the banking system in China is owned by the government. They create their own money.
But we've just heard HSBC, a lot of this money is coming from HSBC,
there's outside investment coming into China. Of course there is. There's outside investment going into India and other places as well. I mean, this is what you'd expect. But the point is, in China, for example, they've had rules for years that if you invest in China, you can only control 49% of the shares in whatever you've invested in. 51% must be locally owned. And that's a very common... You know, they're basically saying to the rest of the world, if we come to invest in you in Africa, you can make that demand of us because it's a reasonable demand. And so they've had technology transfer as a result of this. They haven't just allowed a free-for-all. in India there has been more of a free-for-all, and in Africa there's definitely a free-for-all. And of course the problem with I think they brought the Chinese into the World Trade Organization in year 2000, and they thought that over time they would just become conformist to the way that the West runs it. But in practice, the Chinese have been quite canny about keeping their own way of doing things. Mm-hmm. So at a certain point, for example, they could cancel all the debts. They've got a real problem with property bubbles. But they can cancel all those debts because the money is ultimately owed by the government to itself. They can't do that in the West because it's the private sector that owns all those debts, and they will scream blue murder if you cancel them. Now, that doesn't mean that they want to cancel them. We are clearly in an interdependent world where a crash in the Chinese economy would crash the West and vice versa. Mm. So we're totally mutually dependent.
Right. Yeah.
So, Peter, before we get off this subject of nuclear, I know you've taken us a little way away, but I'm fascinated by the idea that science can actually halt the industry in its tracks back in the 1980s, and so, where they're saying, oh, actually, so they've got their own version of science, and the government, of course, have got their own version of science. The nuclear regulators have got their own version of the science. And that you, just presenting this, can actually get them to change their mind. I'm reminded of a couple of people that I've come across over the years. That's one is Dr. Chris Busby, and another is Dr. Rosalie Bartel, both of whom did a tremendous amount of work in showing that actually, although there's this presentation, nuclear power is something which is safe, fine, you know, that nuclear weapons, well, we just don't really like to think about or talk about them. But these power stations churn out fantastic amounts of very reliable power, baseload, supplying what we need through the winter, this sort of thing. And there isn't really any effect at all on the local population. Well, I wonder if you could say something about their work and what you make of the safety, even in the modern age, of nuclear power.
Yeah, well, I'm somewhere in the middle on this one because I know we had engineers working for us at the Oxford Group, and we modelled what would happen if they lost control of the reactor, which they did at Three Mile Island, and they got away with it because the containment remained intact. It came very close to being cracked. They lost cooling at Fukushima. Reactors actually blew up and completely destroyed the containment. They were very, very fortunate the wind was blowing out to sea. Otherwise, you might have had to evacuate Tokyo. So these are the risks. These are the big risks. When a nuclear power station is in normal production, it produces very little in the way of toxic emissions. They've got that under control. By saying I'm in the middle, I've been surprised that we haven't had more nuclear accidents. So the quality of engineering expertise is high. It has to be. They know that. They live there near the plant. They've got family. So they're very responsible people, and I think we've been not lucky, but it's been the investment in safety and engineering that so far in Europe particularly we haven't had a major accident. It would only take one such, and that would be the end of nuclear power. Nobody would go near it, and all the reactors would be shut down.
I'm reminded of the Windscale, because that was right near the very beginning, the Windscale accident release, right near the very beginning of nuclear power in Britain. But anyway, you've been involved a lot in the modelling of climate change, so I'm really interested to hear what you've found, which has added to that whole discussion debate. I think, personally, I think there's still a big discussion to be had and should be being had about the extent to which man is behind all this, and to what extent there are other factors. But what have you seen about the whole climate change debate, and how have you managed to contribute to understanding modelling these things?
Well, so up until, I would say, 2003, I never looked at the science of climate change. I assumed it was settled, and that we had to do something, and I worked with the government on integrating renewables, and I looked at the renewables planning and thought, my God, you know, it will destroy everything that I care about. Community, landscape, biodiversity. So
we're now hearing about electric cars, aren't we?
Yeah.
And the idea of mass producing these things is going to also massively introduce an increase amount of mining of these things like lithium, etc., around the world. And this doesn't really seem to have been taken on, into account.
Well, it's known. The impacts are known. For example, in the high Andes, where they've got a lot of very ancient salt lakes, there's a lot of lithium there. It's also the breeding ground for some very rare flamingos. There's not many people there. That area is being completely trashed. Just like in China and Mongolia, there's huge areas that are kind of moonscapes because of the rare earth materials that go into producing wind turbines, for example. But your earlier question about the modelling is that in 2003, having accepted that I didn't see anything wrong with the carbon dioxide model, I thought, well, how much time have we got? People like Friends of the Earth were saying, we have to sacrifice the landscape because this is an emergency. And I thought, well, how much of an emergency is it? So I looked at the models and I thought, my God, there are no cycles in there. I'm an ecologist. My whole education in kind of ancient paleoecology is that everything is cyclic. So it's like, this is very strange. And so I spent...
Sorry, you're talking here about things like the Thames freezing over, there were...
Yeah,
it's the,
exactly.
And also the medieval warm period, things like this, the temperature just goes up for a while, goes down again, maybe for 30, 40 years, and up again.
Yeah. At that time, I'd never heard of the medieval warm period. Since then, I realized that it's not just one cycle, medieval warm period, little ice age. It's a regular occurrence. Almost every 1,000 years, 1,500 to 1,000 years, you get this cycle. And therefore, you can predict, looking at the ice core data, you can extrapolate. And Chinese scientists have been doing this. And when you looked at their extrapolation, we are moving into another little ice age. And it goes down in steps about every 60 years. So it's like, well, it's not in the models. So after 3 years of my own research at my own expense, I then started to visit some of the laboratories, talk to people, how difficult it was to put the cycles in, so they left them out. And so I thought, my goodness, this is really, really bad, really bad science. So I wrote the book, Chill, A Reassessment, and said, well, look, if you do all of that, looking at what's not in the models, you end up with a very ambivalent situation where it may not get any warmer, it might even get cooler. It's very hard to predict because it depends on what nature is going to do. And actually, after the book, I did more research on what's actually driving the natural cycles. And so when that's done, you realize that the carbon dioxide model has to be out by a factor of 2 or 3. And so it's not that carbon dioxide has no effect at all. It's very tiny. And the Earth can probably adapt quite easily to that level. It's not, you see a graph and it's presented by the media, 40% increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That's real enough. And they always show this straight line, a linear line. But the effect of carbon dioxide is not linear. It's logarithmic. So the higher the concentration goes, the less power you have to heat. So the line bends and then flattens out at about 400 parts per million, which is where we're at now. So the additional effect of putting more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere is, quite frankly, minuscule. It's minuscule compared to the amount of energy coming in and out from the sun every year. It's absolutely minuscule. So you think, my goodness, that's what have they done? They've made some classic errors within the modeling. Now, I spent a bit of time criticizing this, and eventually they had agreed that, okay, we may have made some mistakes here, but you have to produce your own model. Now, 20 years ago, we could do that. Now, it would take $3 million, and I don't have a team. So I'm saying, all right, you're not going to talk to me unless I have my own model. Now, the only people who have a decent model and are actually matching more or less what's happening, and I don't know enough to pick their model apart. There's a small team in Russia, interestingly enough, and somehow they've handled the issue of cycles in a better way. But I don't have the resources to go over there and find out. Now, what I will tell you is this, that after the publication of the book, I'd had a good reputation with scientists. I never had any problems talking to scientists. But I was attacked by people who I had assumed were my friends, the environmentalists, the Greens, the left liberal consensus, the woke people that we talk about today.
So hang on. In what way were you attacked? Were you attacked for your facts or...
No, they wouldn't even read the book. What actually happened is that a journalist, who I will not name at this stage, got hold of my autobiography. Now, behind the scenes, I'm also a yogi. And in...
What does that mean?
It means that you spend a lot of time in meditation and development of your consciousness. And in that situation, during my work, in those days when I was a consultant to Greenpeace and to trade unions and to government, I was also practicing yoga and increasing my inner abilities and inner vision, if you like. So I talk about, in my autobiography, how difficult it was to maintain the presence in the political world and also develop myself spiritually. And I mention a number of things. Astrology, homeopathy, astral travel. And those are things which, in certain communities, are perfectly okay to mention. It doesn't mean that I believe
in... I would have thought a lot of the Greens would actually be quite into that kind of thing.
You would think so, but it's not the case. The original Greens that I grew up with and was part of, I actually helped to draft the Ecology Party's constitution in Oxford.
Well, when was
that? Many years ago. 1978.
That's right. That was a very old party, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I'm very close friends with David Taylor, who was a leading figure in the Green Party for quite some time, and it's changed. It's now effectively technocratic, and pushing this agenda of total control. Mm. And so-called green issues, and very happy to collaborate with the World Economic Forum and other such
people.
Well,
this is a bit worrying, isn't it? I mean, I can remember we had on this, when we were on FM, this programme, we had Eleanor Cumley, who's was at the time, the leader of the Green Group on Bristol City Council, and a physicist, and put to her some of the figures to do with the amount of energy used in the mobile data networks compared to the... fiber networks, and the ratio is something like 10,000 to 1 in order to get data from one point to another point. It's very, very much more energy inefficient to use the mobile data services. This is when we were first talking about introducing these big 5G masts in Bristol.
Yeah, yeah.
And she just had nothing to say about it. And I thought, as a physicist, surely, you know, you can understand that you're using 10,000 times more energy to do this. It's not necessarily going to be very green.
Mm. A lot of what the Greens are doing is not very green at all. You know, Drax burning wood chips, which are cutting down forests in Canada or Louisiana or whatever. So I understand now that we're dealing with a different kind of green person. I've also witnessed a lot of anti-democratic tendencies within the Greens, Extinction Rebellion and so forth. So,
well, hang on. Extinction Rebellion. If I was sitting there from Extinction Rebellion, I would say, well, actually, we're just a campaign group highlighting these issues to the public and to the press and to the politicians. Someone's got to do that.
They're not intelligent enough to do that. What they do is they campaign, they go, and they stand outside Parliament and they say, government, please do something more. And that's the last people you should be asking to do something, because they're the ones who created the problem in the first place. And so Extinction Rebellion have no policies. They've no intelligence whatsoever.
Well, hang on, because the energy industries do lobby government, don't they, quite successfully?
Yes.
So why shouldn't XR do the same?
Well, because they're not intelligent enough to lobby. They can only protest. They do not have any other solution than to say to government, you need to do more. And so government go, oh, yes, very happy to do more. Give us as much money as we can get in the way of green taxes and so forth. And we'll give you more turbines, do Extinction Rebellion talk about nuclear power? I don't think so. Do they talk about organic farming? No, I don't think so. Do they talk about a vegetarian diet? Have they done the studies that show that those kind of things would bring back wildlife? No, they go on about they get on the street, they make a big fuss, and then they start talking about climate change and how the government must do something, or Greta Thunberg, the government's not doing anything. This is ridiculous. There are vast amounts of capital being sucked into the green agenda in technology. And as for helping the developing countries to cope with climate change, what will actually happen is the merchants of the turbines will show up with government money to say, here is a 100 million grant, but you need to buy our turbines. So this is something that is it's a deep problem which Extinction Rebellion don't even think about. So when I come back from abroad 2018 and I saw all these people on Westminster Bridge, I thought, oh, these are my kind of people. They care about nature. There were Krishna devotees singing bhajans, and I thought, oh, wow, this is really, really encouraging. And then, hang on a minute, all I was getting was, we need to do something about climate change. Oh, somebody should talk to them. So I actually tried. Oh, they don't want to know. There's no discourse, there's no debate. They think they know, and all I can say is they just don't have any sense of what they're really doing.
Well, it's a real pity, because it almost seems as if they have become the very kind of organisation that's not listening, that they're supposedly trying to overcome. Now, I know one of the things when it comes to modelling climate, this is absolutely at the heart of all of this, is if you can model the climate correctly, then you can deal with whatever problems arise. But I know one of the big contributors to being able to understand what our climate is doing is satellite technology. The images that we're getting from satellites enable us in real time, actually, to see what's going on planet Earth and to see if something is untoward. And it literally, you could almost sit there and say, hey, guys, problem with the South Pole. Something needs to be done immediately. Now, obviously, when it comes to changing the composition of the gases in the atmosphere, you can't flick a switch. But you can, assess very long term with these. I mean, there's satellite images now for many decades. What changes there are, and then actually have a plan about how to deal with them.
Well, that's where we would have to part company, because what science does is you throw a problem at it, predict climate, and says, "All right, give us a lot of money, and this is billions of dollars to build the models, and we'll come up with an answer." Then you have the policy people and saying, right, that answer needs to be very clear and very specific. So the climate science community gradually removes all their caveats and says, yes, we've got a problem, and here you have to do something about it, which is emission control. And what they're not saying is, I'm sorry, but this problem is too complex. The environment is too complicated to model. We're in no position to model what the climate's doing, because the climate is ruled by cycles. Those cycles are not precise enough to predict. The long cycle that you mentioned, Little Ice Age, medieval warm period, it's between 1,000 years and 1,500 years in recent six cycles, for example. So you think, yeah, well, hang on a minute. We're trying to predict the next 50 years. You can't do it, because you don't know where you are in the cycle, and you can't put it into the computer model, so they leave it out. And so it's like the honest answer from the scientists would be, sorry, we can't give you an exact prediction, and there's no point in giving us all that money. But what you need to do is create systems which are robust and resilient to change in any direction.
Okay, well, look, you're talking about being a yogi. It's no good cursing the darkness. What suggestions have you got for the way policy should go? Do we need to have a lot of resources ploughed into dealing with climate change?
We need to have a lot of resources put into making society resilient and robust. And actually, climate is virtually bottom of the list of things we need to be robust to. Right now, the whole of our environment could be changed overnight by a collapse of the financial system or a solar flare, a really strong solar. They're fairly
now
regular.
Martin Summers is sitting here. He will say a war.
A war? A nuclear war with a nuclear fairly war. Dramatic
you have a
ecological
nuclear,
effects.
You'd have a definite bit of global cooling with a nuclear winter,
you would
you?
Absolutely. So these are the issues So you need to create a more peaceful society. You need to invest in peacemaking, not more and more effective weaponry. And given the natural situation, the climate could cool in quite a rapid way. It has done in the past. And so you need to prepare society for these things. And instead of pursuing this continual obsession with material growth, one needs a different economic model, fundamentally. Now, I'm not a specialist in this field. I would love to have a model. I don't have one that I can say this would work. And at the moment, there isn't an alternative to the current world development model. But the world development model is the problem. And what they're doing in China, vast skyscraper villages of workers, huge amounts of cement, oil, the resources are being sucked in. The same would be the Middle East or Singapore or parts of Central America or whatever. It's like vast cities. Get the people off the land, put them in cities, mechanize agriculture, big corporations coming in, especially in Africa. This is heading for more and more disaster. We need a wholly different approach, and that, unfortunately, cannot be made by the current financial and economic system. I've talked to bankers on this issue. They feel stuck. They can't provide an alternative. So the place I've come to, Tony, is this is civilization on the brink of disaster, and that's what's going to happen. It's going to come down. And what I'm doing now is talking to people, and you mentioned yoga. It's like you need a set of values which will give you strength and resilience for the time ahead. You need to forget material possessions and all of the things that might have motivated you. You need to go
But I've just bought an electric car.
Right. Well, I don't think that will last.
Maybe I could sell the battery secondhand.
Yeah.
Worth a few bob.
So it's all about that kind of robustness and resilience and a shift in values. And yoga brings people into their internal self and their internal strength, and they're less easily manipulated by all of these forces at play. And so that's going to be essential for the future, because...
Well, yeah, I wonder if you've come across these accelerationists, because they're a branch of Nietzschean philosophy that actually think that it's a good idea to create these crises because it gives the elites more of a chance to change society in their interests. So I think it was Naomi Klein that did the book The Shock Doctrine probably 15 years ago or so now, and she talks a lot about this whole idea of disaster capitalism. Well, you create a disaster, you make a lot of money, and you actually accrue a lot of wealth. Now, if you can push on this thing called the cost of living crisis, where people can't afford to pay the rent, well, who is it that's going to be taking over all that property? It's the elites. They all look down and they'll say, well, actually, we happen to have loads of money in the bank here. Let's buy up all these houses. In fact, I was reading that HSBC Bank, the very same people you were talking about earlier, were boasting that they want to be the biggest landlord in the country by 2030, and they're obviously hoping that all the people that have got mortgages with them won't be able to pay their mortgage, and so they'll be just simply either renting off the bank or they'll repossess those homes. So there, people can make money by taking over markets, by actually creating a crisis. Now, it might be what Martin was saying about war. You know, people don't like to think that people make money out of war, but they do as well, don't they?
Well, it's quite a long history of people making money out of war. The very first Rothschild bank specialized in lending money to royalty in order to persecute wars. And so the suspicion was then that those interests would actually foment more wars in order to make more money.
So, well, it's the famous story, isn't there, about Nathan Rothschild, his intelligence service being legendary, bringing him the news of the Wellington's victory at the Battle of Waterloo to the City of London before anybody else, and in fact quite a long time before anybody else, with horsemen riding to the coast, then across the coast to London, and then he went into the stock exchange and held his head down and started to sell, sending a signal to all all of the other investors in the stock exchange that we'd lost, and that convinced everybody to sell as well. And he was quietly buying up all those stocks at very, very cheap prices. So this is a fantastic way to accrue wealth, but it's not a very good way to run society.
Well, absolutely. What I'm thinking at the moment is that if you can create a psychology of fear and a sense of emergency, which is what we saw with COVID, then certain elements can make a lot of money from that, as we know with the pharmaceutical industry and governments throwing hundreds of billions at those particular sectors. So the same is true. The banking people, if you want to call them the elite, but they're basically investment analysts. And
well, the reason I use the word elite is because they seem to be above the law. We've had all these various scandals, libel scandal, the Forex, foreign exchange cheating scandals. All these are various kinds of frauds of different levels, many involving billions of pounds, dollars, fines as well for many of the banks. And yet nobody jailed, hardly anybody. Actually, there were one or two jailed, usually low-level people. But
yeah,
anyway,
well,
they seem to be above the law, which is, you know, that obviously is a bit problematic.
The problem is that what you're describing is a certain percentage of the banking system that is clearly corrupt. It's the 95% that is actually working within the law and is making all the investment decisions. All these skyscrapers you see in the City of London and in every other city are full of analysts, and they're looking for a return on their investments. Now, what does that mean? It means they get to decide who gets the money, who gets the loan. So your bank manager, and whether that's local or global, your bank manager is making the decision about what gets built, what gets invested in. And this is not democratic.
No, Martin, this is a big change, isn't it? Actually, over the last 40, 50 years, is governments don't have a vision for the future. It's the banks and the people who are doing the investing that have a vision for the future.
Well, that is true. And, of course, the banking system collapsed in 2008 and had to be bailed out by the boring old taxpayer, didn't it? And of course, that should have been the point at which the direction was changed. But of course, they were bailed out, and then they're able. This is the argument against bailing out failing industries. They're then able to say, right, well, we want to go back to doing it the way we were doing it before, and that should have been stopped at that point, but it wasn't. There's a tendency for finance capital to invest in real estate because real estate rises in value automatically, and therefore that then sucks resources from things like innovative small companies. But the model we've now got is one in which that is the way of it. Mm. And of course, if you allow yourself to go down that road, you then get these huge, humongous bubbles, which is what we've got, the biggest bubble in history, and it's going to burst. And when it does, the consequences are going to be what they're going to be. They're going to be dramatic. But of course, what's actually happened in the recent past is that the Chinese and Russian governments, who are semi-detached from this, are starting to think, I mean, Russia, for example, is thinking in terms of self-sufficiency. They've got everything they need. They're probably the only country in the world that probably got everything they need within the borders of the country.
And no debts,
because they paid all the debts off. That's right.
Talking about debts, if I can interrupt you, this week we've seen UK interest rates rise to 3.5%, what the Bank of England's decision means for your money. Homeowners on tracker rates will see payments go up immediately. Credit card costs will increase, but some savers will benefit. So 3.5% doesn't seem a lot, but it's actually more than for many years. I wouldn't like to guess exactly how many years it's been.
Since 2008.
Okay, so what do you think this means now, starting to bring interest rates up? Because we've seen this very, very low interest rate for people borrowing, if you can persuade the bank to lend you the money, because obviously the banks have got a lot of discretion.
Well, they make the decisions, you see.
Yeah, we think, no, actually we won't. And you, Mr. Person doing genetic engineering of humans, yes, actually we think that we will lend you some money. But anyway, a lot of people have borrowed, particularly for buying homes, at this low interest rate. Now this interest rate's going up, Martin. It's starting to creep up now, isn't it?
It is, and in actual fact, in historic terms, that's a fairly low interest rate. But people have got used to being addicted to heroin since 2008. The system was preserved by basically giving loads and loads of cheap money via the private banks. They could have put the cheap money in people's hands, not through the private banks, which is what you should have done. But of course, they're not going to do that because then the private banks dominate the system. So it should have been ringing alarm bells a long time ago. Interest rates, at negative interest rates, we've had, you know, with the rate of inflation being what it is, people are actually, you know, you haven't got a positive interest rate at all. And even then, the economy doesn't take off because there's too many deflationary pressures in it. And picking up on what you were saying earlier about we do need to change the economic model. But we can't just say that poor people around the world are going to have to just carry on being poor. There's got to be social change. And an obvious one, of course, is land reform in developing countries like Brazil. The best land in the country is used to grow stuff for consumer products in the West. It should be used for growing food for local people. And it's the quality of the material wealth that you've got that matters. We're going to have to, you know, we can't move towards a steady state society until we've actually solved the problem of poverty, which requires fundamental political changes.
Well, I wouldn't disagree with that, but what I would do is to add to it that one needs to be careful about how poverty is defined.
Sure.
So, for example, I've spent a fair bit of time in Africa with people who've got nothing, and they've been astonishing people. Happy, fit, sensitive, intelligent, connected. And so what counts for them is A, community, B, having enough good food, peace, and freedom from oppression and war. So if you have whatever, say $5 a day cash, and you have all those other things, that $5 a day mounts up in a year, and you can buy a few things with it. But if you are moved forcibly, which happened in Colombia, for example, not Africa, 400,000 hectares to produce biofuels for the European market, forcibly 2 million people landless and moved to cities.
Yeah.
And if you have $5 a day in a city, you are poor.
Well, that's right. I agree with that. I actually went to Colombia on a trade union delegation in 2005. And of course, the war is war by multinationals to drive people off the land so that they can then take the resources.
Yeah.
And of course, there is a resistance from that.
Yeah.
The Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia have been fighting since the 1940s and so on. But in Kerala in southern India, they've got the same per capita income as in Bangladesh.
Uh-huh.
But there is no comparison in terms of the quality of life. Because they've had the basically left forces in power in Kerala since the 40s. So they redistributed the land. They gave everybody support for family planning so that people voluntarily reduced their child to one child per person, per family. And the quality of life there is very high, even though the actual per capita income is low.
Precisely.
These are the models. But of course, you've also got to carry it. And they were only able to do that because they were inside the Indian Federation and therefore protected from the predation of the United States and the others who, in places like Colombia, you're totally exposed to the
totally
US,
exposed.
The US pressure.
So I'd like to come to one of the issues that came up before about the intelligence or lack of it of Extinction Rebellion. The level that we're talking about now is sophisticated. They don't talk on that level. They go to government and say, please sort it out. We've got an emergency, nature, climate, which they believe in, and they're young people and they're passionate, but they're being misled.
Yeah, what's going on there is a generation that ought to be involved politically. I'm thoroughly improve of that, but they're being given simplistic stuff to
and
work
this is
with.
This is the danger. And
I mean, Greta Thunberg, does she know that what happened at Utoya, where the Labour Party young socialists were all massacred by Breivik, but he was probably working with networks inside the NATO intelligence services.
Yeah. Well,
now that's not the sort of thing that Greta and her parents bother to think about.
But it's not affecting the climate. I mean,
no,
that's
I know,
what she's
the,
interested
the point
in,
is
Martin.
Somebody like Greta of her age. These are people her age.
Yeah. I think what we're saying here is that, that there is always this kind of young, the new, as the young blood, new people come along, they feel that they want to get politically engaged, go out and demonstrate, and that you seem to be implying that Extinction Rebellion is providing something that is almost a mockery of that. It's a kind of travesty where you're going out to do something, but actually it's a stage that's been set for
you. Their passion is being harvested by other forces, and if you look at the board level of Extinction Rebellion, where its money's coming from, it's not grassroots. There's all kinds of interests that are being used.
Well, we were discussing a few weeks ago the Getty money coming into Extinction Rebellion from the oil family. This woman
wasn't a Getty heiress who gave the money. It wasn't Getty as a corporation. Sure. But I think that the big corporations, the World Economic Forum and all of these people, the bankers, BlackRock, Vanguard, all of these hedge funds, they have decided that the green agenda is a way to fend off real demands for social change. And that they want to dominate that agenda. And that you know, when the COP22 meeting that they had in Glasgow, all of the billionaires turned up. At the Bretton Woods conference in 1947-48 to redesign the financial system, the financial people weren't allowed to attend. It was decided by the government's advisors, people like Keynes and Dexter White, and the finance people were told, we're going to decide what's happening, and then we're going to tell you.
You're describing a kind of creeping fascism here, actually, where the big corporations, including private banks, are basically setting policy.
Well, that's right. And, of course, at the end of the Second World War, they were put in a box because they'd cause all these problems. Whereas, of course, they've managed to come back and they dominate everything. And, of course, they're all in favour of saving the planet now.
Anyway, well, Peter, it'd be nice to hear some solutions from you. What do you think, if you were sitting in the climate change minister's seat or whatever they've got these days, what policies do you think that they should be seriously considering?
I would be looking right now at how to create a resilient system of farming for biodiversity, community and food production. It can be done. We know how to do it. Transport. I would send a delegation to Sweden and I would say, look, you cope with extreme winters and warm summers. So you have to have a transport system that is robust to all of these changes, whether it's going to get warmer or colder. It's impossible to predict. Even in a warming world, you can get colder weather in Britain very easily. The warmth alters the dynamic of the Arctic and the equatorial wind currents, and that alters the ocean currents, and you alter that, you could freeze Britain every winter like in the Little Ice Age. So we need robust and resilient systems, both on a community level, but also on a financial level. Now, I that's way out of my depth, the financial stability. It's very obvious to me that we don't have it, and it's very obvious to me that it's being engineered, and crashes can be engineered because then things can be bought up cheaply and so forth, you know. So this is way out of my expertise area. But we have to have this resilience, and at the moment we don't. Mm. And another issue that came up was investment by Vanguard, insurance companies, AXA, BlackRock, and so forth. Who were the main investors in the Wuhan Institute of Virology?
Well, it was EcoHealth Alliance, wasn't it?
EcoHealth Alliance, which was actually a tiny amount, $3 million.
Yeah.
What did they pay for? They paid for access to the codes and the data.
Yeah.
Now, the big investors, Vanguard, BlackRock, AXA, who built the institute, French company, Winterthur. So it's like, that was where the investment's going. Why? Because the current farming system, pigs and chickens, relies on vaccines and relies on being one step ahead of the diseases that affect that kind of production method, which Wuhan specializes in.
It's intensive production of animals. Basically.
And then if you look at Wuhan now, it's high-rise cell blocks with millions of Chinese all crammed together. All very, very susceptible to disease, incredibly polluted air, And the Wuhan Institute is looking at what might happen in the way of new diseases which could affect them. And that's where EcoHealth Alliance comes in. They're very much interested in that. Now, just down the road, you have a military virology institute that is in totally in cahoots with the commercial operation. And they're going, oh, you're looking at a highly lethal bat virus, but it's not transmissible. Okay, give us the codes. It's all in the science literature, the shifting of the codes over to the military lab. And they then go, well, if the terrorists did this, we'd have to be ready with a vaccine. So they create a chimera, a virus which is a combination of various things. Many virology specialists spotted that immediately.
Yep.
The whole story was suppressed. And that, however it got out, whether it was an accident, whether it's deliberate, it affects the whole global economy.
Yeah.
And this is going on. Every country has their own virology labs.
Well, and of course, millions of lives.
And they are busy making these things called gain-of-function research. This is not the kind of future we should be investing.
Aren't they playing God?
Indeed. These are manipulating nature in ways that it's never been manipulated, and they want to sell us the product of that to say we will manipulate your genome. Oof. Which unfortunately they've already done with the jabs.
Possibly, certainly. It reminds me of the nuclear industry, actually, because the whole idea of man-made elements and creating plutonium in the atomic pile, this is an element that doesn't occur naturally. It seems that we've got this peculiar bunch of human beings that like to create things that don't occur in nature, and actually they don't really care whether it backfires and kills millions of people.
Well, peculiar people is correct, and I think it's behoven upon political people particularly to find out just who these people are and what they believe in, because my understanding is that they are esoterics. They have their own religious practices. And we really need to know how they see the world, because they are the ones who are in charge of what is effectively a civilization in decline. So we need to know. Now, I have
any clues of what they believe? Would you like to share, if you've got any ideas, who these people are and what they believe? Because you get a bad idea in your head, and it can cause all sorts of trouble. Someone out there somewhere might say, well, actually, although that's a bad idea, we like it, we can use it, we can make money from it.
Well, to know a little bit more, you would need to read a book called The Brotherhood by Stephen Knight. It was written in 1984. Now, he was a journalist. He didn't really know what he was dealing with. But you're dealing with a group of people, the Masonic Order, that has secret rituals and rites, and they have their own set of values. It's very architectural. It's a kind of the heartless machine that they have created that is now not only raping nature but producing all of these weapons and the banking system that we've just been talking about. This is a product of a shift in consciousness that occurred in 17th, 18th century when a Masonic order effectively took over the banking system. So you need to know, these guys need to be called to account and say, all right, what do you believe in? Where are you going with all of this?
I don't know if they believe in anything. Surely they just follow orders, don't they? And in fact, they've got where they are in the Masonic system by being obedient, by being pliable.
Then you have to go to the very top and find out who's giving the orders.
Well, that's right. Fascinating. Anyway, we've been talking a lot about the sort of dark green agenda, if you can call it that, and someone else has been doing that this week, and that is the TV presenter Neil Oliver.
You've probably heard that 97% of scientists are agreed that humans are the cause of climate change. It comes from research carried out in 2013. Do you know how that team obtained that number? They gathered nearly 12,000 scientific papers dealing with global climate change. They didn't read the papers, heavens no, that would have been proper research. Instead, they looked at just the summary paragraphs on the front covers. On that basis, they grouped them into four piles. 3,896 papers agreed humans were to blame for climate change. 7,930 took no position either way. 78 rejected the idea of it being humanity's fault, and 40 were uncertain altogether. That initial pass gave a figure of just 32% blaming humans for climate change. Obviously, that wasn't nearly scary enough. So then came the gross and clumsy cheat, the 7,930 papers that took no position on whether humans are to blame were removed from the final analysis. With them gone, the figure of 32% went up to 97%, and the likes of Barack Obama and Al Gore have been quoting it ever since. If my interpretation's correct, this is the kind of deliberate tampering with evidence that underpins the net zero madness that's being pursued by the zealots running our countries, or rather ruining our countries. In a book published in 1997, physicist Carl Sagan wrote the following. We've arranged a global civilization in which most crucial elements, transportation, communications and all other industries, agriculture, medicine, education, entertainment, protecting the environment and even the key democratic institution of voting, profoundly depend on science and technology. We have also arranged things so that almost no one understands science and technology. This is a prescription for disaster. We might get away with it for a while, but sooner or later, this combustible mixture of ignorance and power is going to blow up in our faces. In this context, it's our leaders who either fail to understand science and just parrot whatever propaganda lands in their inbox each day, or they do understand and they're lying. Either way, it's the prescription for disaster predicted by Sagan. Agenda 2030, net zero, is a second Titanic, and this time the whole world's being herded aboard like cattle. The passengers on the original Titanic had no way of knowing what lay ahead for them in the North Atlantic. This time around, though, millions of people who could and should know better, who have no excuse now for not knowing, who could and should have realised long ago that they were being lured and lied towards disaster, are actually buying tickets for the ride on Agenda 2030. A ship of fools. 1,500 people were lost when Titanic went to the bottom. This time it's the lives of billions. I've said it before and I'll keep saying it. What lies beneath all the madness that's keeping so many millions of people perpetually on edge, knowing, just knowing that something somewhere has gone very badly wrong, is an attack on humanity itself. This fact, above all others, must be understood. We are described as useless people. We need to accept smaller, colder, hungrier lives. We should swap beef and chicken for beetles and worms. And if you're white, you're the product of original sin, bad from birth, and owing creation itself an apology just for being here.
So that's a bit of a monologue from Neil Oliver this week. He does his own thing as well as his piece, regular piece on Sundays, I think it is, on GB News. Peter Taylor, who's joining us, is the author of Chill, A Reassessment of the Global Warming Theory. What do you make of Neil Oliver?
Spot on. I have to say, he's very eloquent. And that's exactly the situation that I perceive as well. I would add to that that the world is now divided by people who are waking up to this, that they are on a boat that looks very much like the Titanic, and they're looking at how do we turn it around. And a very large apparent majority, perhaps 60%, are going, oh, well, we're fine. You know, everything's fine. We just keep going in the same direction and everything will improve. And that's the current situation. How that is going to pan out in the next decade, I don't know.
It's fascinating that you should bring in, for me, it's lovely to hear you talking about Stephen Knight, because I several times interviewed Martin Short, who wrote a book called Inside the Brotherhood, and I remember him telling me how, well, after Stephen died in suspicious circumstances, after that book was published in the 1980s, that he was given several boxes of correspondence that had come in since the writing of the book, many of them from former Freemasons, and even serving Freemasons, who could see rather nasty things going on within the craft. And then he published a book called, which was about three times thicker, called Inside the Brotherhood, and also did a three-part series for ITV, which was a really good look, I think. For those of you that don't have the time to go through a great fat book called Inside the Brotherhood by Martin Short, you can just find this ITV documentary up online, which was also, I think, called Inside the Brotherhood, made for ITV. And it's interesting also that you talked about the targeting of these banking institutions by Freemasonry, and that this is obviously not these sorts of people, particularly the loyalty that they have to their own order really makes it inappropriate for them to be in any kind of public position, it seems to me.
Unless we can reform that order, we're in deep trouble, because they are steering the ship. And we need to be able to talk with them. We need to be able to say, hey, first and foremost, where are your women? That they're imbalanced. I've called it in a recent article the dangerously imbalanced, monstrous male mind, the DIM. And we have handed them 10,000 plutonium-tipped weapons, plus all the other things that we've been talking about. They are the ones who are steering the ship. And so I actually am quite hopeful that they can reform themselves, but if they need any help, they need to open up and stop the secrecy, and they need to come clean on their belief system, which is heartless. It's male dominated. It's architectural. It's predictive. They're the ones who create all the models. They're the ones who think they can control everything. They're the ones who began the witching phase. They're the ones who burnt the women. James the First, who's known as the father of Freemasonry, he enjoyed attending witch trials and persecuting what we would call wise women and healers.
Well, let me just say, if there were witch trials today, I think you'd probably find quite a big crowd interested in seeing it going, and maybe be televised or something.
Well, we have a pagan revolution happening through all kinds of ways, shamanism, shamanic dance, trance dance, ayahuasca. Even psilocybin is now being investigated by Imperial College London as a healing tool for anorexia and issues that are very difficult to deal with via pharmaceuticals. Mm. And so there is a shift, there is a revolution happening, and I think we need to be able to access, and this would be an invitation to the Masonic Order, which is open up, listen to us. Don't try this repression and control, because the ship is heading for the crisis ahead, and you won't survive it. And so let's get together and let's change the system.
Well, I think it's really lovely to hear you saying that you want to persuade them to change rather than to force a change, because it's not going to be. I mean, for a long time, actually, there were rules, for example, here in Bristol and right across the country, that if you were going to be in a public position, that you had to declare your membership of the secret societies. I know Jack Lopresti, who's an MP for North Bristol, he wrote when he was a councillor for a very short period of time. He said, in the form where he declares his interest, there's a little thing saying, are you a member of a secret society? And he put down, I'm a Freemason, but it is not, underlined, a secret society. So he's in denial, really, about whether he's in a secret society or not. But the point is, at least he admitted it. There may be many others that aren't. And most importantly, we're now in a position where there is no requirement for anyone to put that down in their register of interest.
Right. That's great. And also, whilst it's true that the majority of Freemasons are not a secret society, the upper levels are totally secret. The rituals are totally secret. And what you need to do is do a little bit of research back to 1982 and a lodge in Rome called P2.
Oh, yeah. we were talking about that just a couple of weeks ago, yeah.
Yeah, headed by an adept, Licio Galli. But around that table were not only the banks in the form of Roberto Calvi, who was murdered, perhaps because he woke up to what was happening and he fled to London and ended up dead. But sitting around that table was the whole power structure of the country, including the media baron, Silvio Berlusconi, the mafia, Michel Sindona, who was later tracked to the Bush Ranch in the USA, effectively, the biggest businesses on the planet are run by the mafia. Pornography, trafficking, all of that dark side. And, of course, the media have enormous power. So they were all sat around, and the Italian government broke that up because it has a branch of the magistrates who are very brave, and they have to go after the mafia. And so they broke the lodge open. And they warned all the capitals of Europe and said, we've got evidence that there are lodges like this in all the major capitals of Europe.
Well, P2 stands for Propaganda Due. And I remember reading, gosh, must be about 15 years ago now, in John Robison's Proofs of a Conspiracy Against All Religions and Governments, which was written in, I think it was 1792, about the propaganda lodges. So there you go, all the way back. Martin, this is a tough nut to crack, isn't it? Secret societies. Do you think they have much of an influence these days?
Of course they do. I mean, Propaganda Due is well known. Imposimato is the head of the Italian Supreme Court, wrote a book called La Repubblica dei Stragi Impuni, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres, which came out in 2012. And he was the investigating magistrate on the kidnap of Aldo Moro, the prime minister, the bombing of Bologna railway station, and so on. What's missing from what I'm hearing from you is the intelligence services were sitting around that table.
Yes.
MI6, CSME, CIA. These people are the coordinators. And if you're saying, well, who's behind it all? Well, I can tell you, the Russian FSB know who's behind it all. It's their opponents. Just as the Chinese intelligence services suspect that the Wuhan laboratory leak was a deliberate leak, Jeffrey Sachs is now saying, he's on the board of the Lancet, he's saying it's become clear that this was a modified virus.
Oh, yes, it was clear.
I think that's being established. And, of course, he's been silenced, but it's out there. And, of course, the Israeli Times of Israel informs us that in November 2019, the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States told the Israeli Defense Forces that there was a pandemic going to come out of China. At that stage, the Chinese didn't know that. So that's evidence of foreknowledge by the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States of America. Now, it may be that they're working through Freemasons, lodges and so on, but from my point of view, I would say you don't need to have a esoteric theory to explain this. These are the kinds of things that intelligence services do as war fighting, and they've been doing it for years, and most people are just completely blind to how vicious the deep state actually is. But if you look at things like 9/11, that is carried out by the deep state in everybody's face.
Yeah, let's bring it back home to 7/7, the 7/7 London bombings as well.
Of course, that's right. And it was investigations by people we know that showed that the train that the bombers supposedly caught that morning didn't leave Luton Station that morning. And the government had to admit, John Reid, Home Secretary at the time, had to go to the Commons and say, actually, we've got to admit that the train that we claimed the bombers had caught didn't run that morning, because the people we know went to the Connex Rail in Luton and asked them, and said, well, we've been expecting the police to come and ask us this. So what we're dealing with is very, very heavy
also,
manipulation.
I mean, just particularly with 7/7, got to mention the complete and utter lack of CCTV coverage of any of these people actually on a train or getting into a train, as well as the announcement by Mark Honigsbaum at The Guardian, who was there on the scene saying that the people who were coming out of the Edgware Road tube station were saying that the bomb was underneath the train.
Yes, well, they had the French.
And then I spoke to him about 2 months after that, where he said, well, not everything I put in the I submit as copy ends up in the next day's newspaper, because in the newspaper the day after, in contrast to his audio report on the day itself, it said the bombs were inside the trains, not under the train. So, you know, these sorts of things get manipulated through the press, quite right. But look, before we say goodbye to Peter, I thought it'd be interesting to look at this interest rate change this week, and also to look at the whether they're modelling this right. The attempt is to put interest rates up because investment is going to the United States, where the interest rates are higher. Money's going to the US. And they're saying, what, Martin?
Well, I mean, that's one of the reasons why you have to put the interest rate up if you're the Bank of England. Because if they're going to raise interest rates in the US, which they are, then they will suck all the capital to the US. It's part of a manipulation. And you can say that I'm actually not in favour of raising interest rates, and there's quite a lot of mainstream economic opinion saying this. It's not going to work. All you're going to do is potentially crash the economy, and that's not the point.
Anyway, we're going to also have a brief chat about the strikes. So let's have a listen before we do to the ex Office of National Statistics the statistician Jamie Jenkins talking here about the interest rate rises, and also in contrast, he thinks that the interest rates may well fall by next year. So some of the pay increases that the unions are asking for, well, they may be asking for too much, because by this time next year the interest rate may be way down again. So let's have a listen to that little discussion, and we'll let our guests comment afterwards.
This isn't really the Bank of England running monetary policy. This is the US. So yesterday, the Fed in the US increased interest rates there by 0.5%. If we don't follow, what you will then get, a bit like what we saw with Kwasi Kwarteng and Liz Truss, is the value of the pound will go down, because people will invest in dollars because the interest rates have gone up there. So this is partly in response to what we're seeing over there. But interest rates, Mike, they're probably not going to go up too much more, is what people are predicting. Inflation will start coming down. We probably peaked already now, Mike. And if you look at the OBR forecast, it's coming down. And remember what inflation is, Mike. It's the annual change in prices. So if you think back, it was where we saw all the petrol prices going up really high kind of last winter. Well, if you compare what we're seeing now, the prices are starting to come down. And when you get the energy prices compared to, say, a year earlier, when we go further on into 2023, they won't be as high, the increases next year, as they are this year. So inflation will start coming down. Jeremy Hunt says that they have policies to deal with inflation. I don't think the government needs any policy to deal with inflation, Mike. It's the way the numbers work. It automatically come down.
I don't believe that any of the current strikes are actually being done with a view to improving conditions for the workers, getting more money for the workers. They're purely and simply a show of force by the left-wing extremists within those particular unions. And they're not interested in making a settlement with the government. They're only interested in causing a problem and hoping to force this government into an early election.
But they're not going to have an early election. If that's what their plan is, Sunak and Hunt are going to sit this out, Mike, because inflation will naturally come down over the next year. So we'll probably go into the next election with inflation down. And I think, Mike, that's probably why the government aren't really backing down on these strikes, because by the time you get to March, April, May time, when inflation's come down to, say, 6, then 5, then it goes down to 4%, they'll be saying, well, actually, you know, these pay demands that you want, the inflation isn't as much of a problem as what it was. So I think they're playing the long game, the government, and we kind of got this impasse. It's not going to be fixed anytime soon, is it?
So that's Mike Graham and Jamie Jenkins on the Mike Graham programme earlier this week. Interesting point he's making there. He's saying maybe these pay claims, 19%, 18% for the nurses, this sort of thing, are way above what they should be, because inflation, although it's working at the moment at an annual roughly something like 11%, it may be that's come right down in 6 months' time, and we're looking at an annual inflation rate of only something like 6%.
Well, what is the where does Mike Graham show?
This is on Talk Radio.
Talk Radio. It's just called Talk Radio. Okay, I'm just trying to get the
he's
picture.
He's an ex Daily Express guy.
Okay, so this is Daily Express type of opinions. You know, the left wing.
Well, it's a right wing media, like much of the media is.
I think it's absurd. I mean, the nurses' pay in this country has been eroded for years and years and years. It's not just the question of the inflation. The RCN of having their first strike in the 100 years of their existence. And that is because they cannot recruit enough people to work in the health service at the money that's being offered. And the private sector pay deals are ahead of that, but even they're lower than inflation. In fact, real wages are still falling in this country. Inflation will come down because there's going to be an almighty crash and everybody's going to lose their jobs. That's the most likely outcome of raising interest rates. And I think the incompetence of this government is unbelievable. I mean, they lost 30 billion in a week with this stupid, we're going to reduce taxes without costing it. And these are the people who, and think of all the billions that were wasted on pointless PPE contracts given to all of their mates. We're seeing a resurgence of trade union action in this country after a generation of retrenchment. And partly it's to do with the trade union laws passed by the Tories, which mean that you can't go on strike until you've got overwhelming support. And therefore, once you've got overwhelming support, it's quite difficult to call them off. Because if we're going to go on strike and lose money, we expect to get something out of it. And of ultimately, of course, they are trying to change the government. And they may be able to bounce an early election. Let's hope so, because, no, that may happen, Tony. Don't forget the Tory party itself is split all over the place.
The Conservatives have got a massive majority. They're not going to give that up, are they?
It doesn't matter, because in actual fact, they can't agree about what to do. Even Tory MPs are saying they're going to have to back down.
I think we've got to be realistic here, right? They don't have to do anything. They've got a massive majority. So they may as well just sit there and use that majority to do anything they can do. They certainly don't want to have a general election.
Of course they don't want an early general election, but events, dear boy, events can cause all kinds of problems.
Would you like to give us an example of what you think might happen?
Well, it could be that there's going to be a major blow-up in the Ukraine and NATO gets involved and the economy just crashes smash-bang-wallop. And of course, you know, the Northern Ireland Protocol is about to be ripped up. You could end up with a trade war with all of our nearest neighbours, all of which will then cause panic in certain sections of the Conservative Party who won't want to compromise over the Northern Ireland Protocol. But if they don't compromise, then they're going to crash the economy. All of this is happening, and you can see what happened in the by-election yesterday, is that the Labour Party strolled home. And that's what the opinion polls are showing. And that's why quite a lot of Tory MPs, even young ones, are resigning, because they can see there's no future for their party in terms of running this country. And, of course, people in the Daily Express don't like to hear that, do they?
No, they don't. Peter, would you like to just give us your view on the industrial action we've been seeing? Because it is, I can remember this just about in the 1970s. We haven't really seen so much, have we, with the nurses out for the first time ever this week?
Yeah, well, I'm not an economist, but I'm just struck by the fact that it's the first time nurses have engaged in strike action. And these are mostly women, and they care. So it makes me feel very emotional what's happening. And I'm on their side. You know, and the problem is, though, that we don't have a system of proper governance and management. We have a whole bunch of bosses whose loyalties are primarily financial, and the system has to be changed. Why are workers having to fight? They should be on the management boards. They should be
involved.
They
are in some countries.
Yes. And that
where one countries they that, are.
That's what should happen. And something like the National Health Service should have the caring people involved so that they can make sure that these kinds of issues don't arise.
Well, unfortunately, many of the people working now in these management positions in the caring, so-called caring professions, I always remember seeing a Daily Mail headline, "The Cruelty of the Carers," which made me shudder to read it, are straight from big business. They're from business courses, and they're treating hospitals as if they are sausage factories. But anyway, we have also, before you go, Peter, I'd like you to have a listen to Prime Minister's Questions, where this whole idea of the nursing strike came up. And I think this is, in a way, is a test, isn't it, for the leader of the opposition, Keir Starmer. I mean, we don't expect the man from Goldman Sachs, the leader of the Conservative Party, to have a lot of compassion for the nurses. So let's see how Keir Starmer does.
He goes again pretending everything is fine. Try telling that to those on waiting lists or those that can't afford to pay for a next day GP appointment. After 12 years of Tory failure, winter has arrived for our public services, and we've got a Prime Minister who has curled up in a ball and gone into hibernation. If he can't act on behalf of patients or nurses or everyone who wants these strikes called off, then surely the whole country is entitled to ask, what is the point of him and what is the point of the government he's supposed to be leading?
Mr. Speaker, he talks about COVID not having an impact. Ambulance waiting times for Category 1 ambulance waiting times in February of 2020 were actually completely on target, Mr. Speaker. COVID has an impact, and that's why, as the chief executive of the NHS has acknowledged, this government is serious about its commitment to prioritise the NHS. But, Mr. Speaker, let's just have a look at the NHS in Labour-run Wales, shall we? The worst A&E times in the country, Mr. Speaker.
So that's this week's Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday. Peter, what do you make of the... is there much point in them having these sort of discussions? And how do you think the Leader of the Opposition did, Keir Starmer?
Well, to be honest, I'm not impressed by the opposition, as it's called. It doesn't seem to me to offer a real alternative. Maybe I'm wrong and that there are some really sensible policies, but I haven't seen them. To fight what's going on, it's easy enough to score points in that way. But the problem is the crisis has occurred and there has to be a solution. And to replace the one government with another, we need something new. I don't know.
Do you think Jeremy Corbyn represented anything new?
Yes, I do. What he represented was integrity. And, you know, I have three sons they were in this country. And they were saying, "Guy, come, Dad, listen to this guy." And they were inspired by Jeremy Corbyn. They could relate to his integrity. And what I saw then was the system, especially the media, undermine and eventually destroy that initiative, because obviously it would have threatened a lot of the established interests. So I think, yes, Jeremy Corbyn did represent something, and he also represented a different style of leadership from the rear, where, you know, it's like not grabbing the headlines and but actually encouraging people to be more in their own power. And it's a different style of leadership, collective leadership. I have to say I was impressed myself. But, of course, it was doomed, one could see that. So we need to look at what's happened. Starmer is a lawyer. I don't have a lot of faith in lawyers. What's lacking somehow with the opposition? It's woke, primarily. They're not offering a real alternative to the development model. They're not really. They're totally in. They've been captivated by this whole climate business, by everything. That they're not really offering a proper alternative. They have to harness the true integrity, and they have to harness the caring nature of most humans, and somehow, and I don't know how, get rid of this repressive, controlling, dangerously imbalanced, monstrous male mind. That's the problem.
Martin, you voted for Keir Starmer. You're a member of the Labour Party. What's happened to the party? I mean, Peter's just saying here he thinks actually Jeremy represented a possible future there.
Well, I voted for Jeremy Corbyn as well. I didn't vote for Rebecca Long Bailey because of, you know, these are tactical decisions. But I totally agree that the Starmer represents the establishment. They are hoping that they will end up in power because the Tories clearly, I mean, the Kwasi Kwarteng Liz Truss budget just had, you know, professional economists and others just rolling their eyes. It was clearly not going to work. It was just stupid. And of course, that means that they lose their aura of invincibility and competence as a result of that. And of course, Starmer has positioned the Labour Party to be the sensible uncle who will take over. But of course, they don't want to challenge any of the basic things. Okay. They're not going to do that. And what Jeremy Corbyn should have done is committed to proportional representation so that you could build a coalition of forces. Because not everybody is part of the Labour tradition, well, of which I am.
One of the things,
yes,
that
some
Jeremy
people are Greens, some people are Liberals, some people are Scottish Nationalists, Sinn Féin, whatever. All of these different oppositional forces need to cooperate, and that's not easily done in a first-past-the-post setup.
One of the things that Jeremy Corbyn did talk about was something called the People's QE, didn't he? The idea of rather than making up money and giving it essentially to prop up asset and share prices, to actually give it to the poor, because they actually spend it and get the economy going.
Well, in actual fact, the Labour manifesto, which Jeremy lost the election on, was a comprehensive worked out policy and in lots of different ways. And a lot of the things, I mean, renationalisation of the energy industry, it's a no-brainer. That's why we had it nationalised for many, many years. Yeah. And that's why the Russians haven't denationalised theirs. And why the Chinese National Oil Company belongs to the Chinese government.
Unfortunately, Jeremy Corbyn's own party were working against him in those general elections. Anyway, that's a whole other story. But I'd just really like to thank you genuinely, Peter, for coming in and sharing your thoughts, particularly your book. Do you want to just sum up? This is called Chill, a reassessment of the global warming theories, because you do say, don't you, as part of the title of it, that you want to say what we should do about it.
Yes, indeed, and in fact, a good half of the book is relating to that. It's like, okay, what's a resilient way forward? Because we do know how to make a resilient and robust system. And as the whole discussion is, it's very interesting, very encouraging for me that we can talk at this level, because it's that financial system and whoever is behind it and whatever their beliefs are against turning the ship around, and it's heading for disaster. So we're dealing with what's important here, I think. More important than the climate. Climate is changing very slowly. And most of it's natural. That's what I said in the book. You can't actually alter what the climate is doing, but you have to be prepared for what it will do, either way, colder or warmer. We can do that. We know how to do that. The problem is there are very powerful vested financial interests in not doing the right thing.
Well, anyway, thanks ever so much for joining us. And we're going to have a listen now to... We've been talking there a bit about the strikes going on, the industrial unrest. I suppose that's what they always used to call it anyway. And this week, Bristol got into the news with the rather unfortunate situation where lots of posts has been left outside getting snowed on, rained on, and actually rats filmed and... Foxes filmed sniffing around, chewing into people's parcels, this sort of thing. And what was most worrying was that the person that actually confirmed that this was taking place, even though the photos had been around, was from the Communication Workers Union here in Bristol. Ben Watts was actually suspended just for simply talking to the BBC. Now, this is pretty horrific. But anyway, I had quite a good chat to the Southwest Regional Organiser for the Communication Workers Union, the Posties, Kevin Beezer, about the and also I asked him the awkward question, which is about the timing. If you're having a strike during the Christmas rush and Granny might not get her Christmas card as a result, don't you think you're losing public support?
My name's Kevin Beezer. I'm the CW Southwest Regional Secretary. So in relation to Ben Watts, who's the elected CW Bristol and District Branch Secretary, fortunately the business Royal Mail Group have suspended him, precautionary suspended him, in respect of an interview that he'd done with the BBC, which the union is dealing with. There's a set procedure and process that we're dealing with. And obviously, for various reasons, we can't comment on the details of what Royal Mail have accused him of. The union will defend him 100%, and we will deal with that appropriately.
Okay. You obviously know the situation pretty well. Do you think that Ben has actually been telling the public anything inaccurate via the BBC?
I think no. I mean, look, we've got a number of officials up and down the country that have been suspended on spurious trumped up charges, which the union is dealing with. And we will deal with that because it's unacceptable. I think Ben, along with other officials, has been targeted in quite a nasty dispute with Royal Mail Group. And I think that's unfortunate. I think it's childish. It doesn't resolve the situation. It makes it worse. And unfortunately, the employers made a decision, people at the top, to target CW reps. And unfortunately, Ben is now one of those people.
Can you just give us a bit more of a background on the current dispute? Because I understand that the Royal Mail are actually threatening to get rid of a lot of posties and replace them with casual labour.
Yeah, I mean, although, you know, the media, right-wing media, I should say, have peddled that it's, you know, greedy postal workers along with other people that are out on strike in different industries about pay. The pay really is a secondary issue, although, you know, our members deserve, given that they've worked very, very hard, they've worked through the pandemic, a decent pay rise. This is about terms and conditions. This is about taking jobs out of the industry and backfilling them with people paid a lot less money, agency staff, subcontractors, etc. And this is about the people at the top that, you know, have got their noses in the trough in regards to share options and pay right across the CEOs and board, and also giving shareholders more money. And the reason they want to cut their costs is labour costs. And that's what this dispute is about, terms and conditions and job losses.
How many people could lose their jobs as a result of this? And maybe you could also explain, what difference is it for people? I mean, for anyone who's sort of getting their post from day to day, it may make no difference at all.
Well, it will make a big difference. So I'll give you an example at the moment. They have broken our MTSF agreement, which is effectively our redundancy terms and process. And they have undermined that, and they are... This is voluntary, 10,000 jobs that they've offered out, which will be gone effectively by the end of January. Now, you take in the context, there's 11,000 agency staff in Royal Mail Group, and they want to make 10,000, you know, substantive Royal Mail employees. And also they then want to bring people in on less terms and conditions on top of that. So it's effectively their way of sifting people out of Royal Mail and backfilling them with cheaper people. And when you say, ask the question about what that effect will have, that means you're not going to get well-trained, committed people that have been in the post office, Royal Mail Group, I should say, for many, many years, given a decent service. What we're going to have is a race to the bottom with agency staff and people paid a lot less money.
Well, I noticed there's a massive DPD depot just appeared, well, over the last few years, in North Bristol next to the M4. It does look as if these enormous distribution companies, private ones, are sitting there rubbing their hands at the moment, knowing that Royal Mail is in dispute, and actually maybe these big private companies, UPS and people like this, that we see the vans driving around, are just going to simply take over from Royal Mail.
Well, I'm glad you've mentioned DPD, which is at the Emerson's Green, is that the French Postal Service and Telecoms, which is a nationalised company, actually own DPD, and the money, part of the money they make from DPD offsets the costs for the French consumer. So you've got companies like DPD owned by, you know, the state, French state, that effectively, you know, taking the work off of Royal Mail as an example, and they're not the only ones that actually then those costs, the money they make, actually go back into the French postal system and make it cheaper for those people. Now, if you have a look at those private companies, the irony of our dispute is that those companies are struggling through the autumn and Christmas pressure, because normally they put back into their system, if they can't cope with the increase in work, back into Royal Mail Group. Now they're all in trouble in regards to they can't cope because they've got nowhere to put their mail, or sorry, their packets and parcels back into the system because we're on strike.
Going back to the situation with Ben, who's been suspended, is there any evidence that the Royal Mail leadership, the chief executive, etc., are deliberately targeting elected people from the Communications Workers Union, from union reps?
Yeah, I mean, our legal team at Cedar Bed Quarters, and also we're taking legal counsel to deal with these cases, is that it is targeted. We know it's targeted because we can see from the people that have been suspended that happen to be CW reps. And then you look at the actual charges that the Royal Mail have said, you know, that's the reason why we're taking them through the conduct and possibly dismissal, is that it's target approach on false claims. So we know this is going on. We know this is trying to undermine the structure of the union and also put people under pressure. So we will deal with that. The union will deal with that through legal counsel in the process. And there's no way we're going to let union officials be cannon fodder when they're effectively standing up for their members to try and defend jobs, terms and conditions in the service.
It does look as if the chief executive, I'm not sure who they are, of the Royal Mail now. Who is it?
We've got Simon Thompson, who's come from a number of companies I think Morrison's, I think he headed up Track and Trace.
Oh, that's right.
And we've got a number of board members that have come from British Airways in the car industry. I think the total kind of amount of years that they had collectively of working in Royal Mail is something around 6 years that we've been quoted. So they've not been in the business very long. I think we all kind of understand they've been brought in to try and do a hatchet job on Royal Mail, quite frankly. They certainly take plenty of money in regards to kind of their pay and share options. You know, so you can see kind of where they want the company to end up.
Now, this is turning into a bit of a battle between the union and the management and the chief executive, particularly this Track and Trace guy. Which was a test and trace, sorry, wasn't it? A disastrous, many, many millions poured into, I think even billions poured into a program which was totally ineffective, now in charge of Royal Mail. I mean, it's scary to think that they're now in charge of all our letters and post, for God's sake. Do you think you stand a chance against these people? Because they're trying to force these changes through. They seem to have the backing of this Tory government too.
No, I think we're 100% confident. We've had, 13 plus days of industrial action that's run through kind of the autumn period, and now we're right up to December. And we will continue to do that until we get the right deal. Our members are solid. We've seen areas that, you know, whether it's small village, you know, people working for Royal Mail, towns and cities, etc., right across the southwest and right across the UK, is that there's solid action going on, and we're well into a strike, you know, in this difficult period where people are struggling financially. And, you know, losing money is not easy for people. It's tough. And people are resolute because there is so much at stake. You know, their jobs in the future, their terms and conditions about whether that will continue if the business gets their way. So people are standing fast, and they will continue to do so.
Well, they are, but couldn't this backfire? This is a period of time where actually people could turn against the Royal Mail because of the, you know, not simply not getting Christmas cards, Christmas presents, this sort of thing. It's liable to blow up in your face, Kevin.
Well, I don't think so, on the basis of the support that we've got. So what we've seen, we've had, unfortunately, a number of disputes over many years, and I've been on many picket lines over the last, you know, few weeks and months, et cetera, including today, is the support we're getting from the general public and also businesses is been outstanding, because they understand what's at stake, that if we do not get this decision right in agreement, it won't be just, you know, our members' terms and conditions and jobs. It'll be the future of what Royal Mail looks like that serves them. So they understand that. You know, there's no love between the customers and Royal Mail in respect to the way that they've handled this dispute. And they want a resolution, but they also understand that the people in charge are not dealing with it in a professional way.
Now, we know also, obviously, the railway workers, the nurses, there are many others, including university lecturers, in dispute at the moment. Are you working together with other unions very much? Because it does seem as if, you know, there's been, particularly as with the fuel prices going up, inflation has gone through the roof, and everybody is saying, well, we don't want to see our living standards eroded. So are you working together with other unions like that?
Well, I mean, obviously all the disputes are different in a lot of ways, and I suppose in some ways the same. And what I mean by that is, obviously, working people are right under the cosh in regards to pay, cost of living, etc. You know, the Tory government, in regards to the way they deal with public services and public sector, and people need to stand together, and they are. You do, when you look at the legislation in this country and the thresholds you've got to get ballots, yes votes, and then to take people on industrial action, there's lots of unions, you know, look at the RCN, you know, that have managed to achieve that and taken their members out. They don't do that lightly, and all unions don't do that lightly, but that's the pressure that people are feeling, working people that have had enough, quite frankly.
Okay, Kevin Beazer, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
So that's straight from the horse's mouth from the communication workers here, the posties in Bristol, Martin.
Yeah, well, it's a depressing litany, isn't it? Especially the victimisation of union reps.
Ben Watts, in this case.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is actually the same sort of thing as we were hearing last week, weren't we, about the National Union of Mine Workers, the idea that there is a deliberate targeting of union activists as well.
Well, it's been long. I mean, that's been par for the course forever.
They're not interested in solving the dispute, Royal Mail seem to be. And isn't it amazing that the guy who's the chief executive now was the one who's the chief executive of Test and Trace?
Yes, well, I mean, in other words, there's a little elite coterie of people who move in between these different jobs. Well, they've got a shared world view.
Is it incompetence, or is it just that they're pliable people who will do what they're told by others?
They get the job because their job is to break the Communication Workers Union, and that's what their job is. And as far as they're concerned, if that's what they're doing, and that's why the CWU are right to resist them, but they see their job as to don't forget the Royal Mail, when it was owned by the government, the unions had a guaranteed role within that, and now of course they want to just get rid of that and turn it into another private company which will not compete with their other private companies that work on a similar basis.
There's a tug of war going on here, isn't there, really, between the public who pay for their Royal Mail or whatever, and also pay their taxes, and the shareholders who want to be able to invest in Royal Mail because they know they can get a nice return out of it.
Well, the people who bought Royal Mail when it was privatised by Vince Cable made a load of money because it was sold at a price which was not reflective of the value of the business. And that's the same with all of the privatisations. In order to make them successful, the British Gas shares were sold at a fraction of their real value and so on. And of course, this is all handouts to Tory voters with money to spend. And they think, great, this is great. The government is giving me, shares at a value which I can actually make money and go on holiday next year or buy my next new house. And it's all being done by a Tory government, which I voted for. And that's why I vote for them. It's called class war, as, Arthur Scargill or anybody will tell you. That's what it's about. Money for us, not for you.
So the bit of the detail behind what happened to Ben Watts. So Royal Mail suspended him. This is chatting to some of the posties about it. What actually happened was that there were these photographs circulating on social media. And the BBC contacted Ben as a union rep to get him to confirm various things that apparently had been going on, including this leaving the post out in, for animals to sort of jump around and sniff around it and all night and all day. And also the allegation that some of the junk mail, that's what we would call junk mail, but the Royal Mail are paid to deliver this. The whole system is under such strain that some of it had been burnt. So in other words, businesses have been paying Royal Mail to distribute this stuff around to everyone's houses, this annoying junk mail, unless you've got a little sticker on your letterbox saying no junk mail, please. And actually some of it had been burnt because they just don't have the resources to deliver everything. And so, so apparently that's why Ben was suspended, because he confirmed that some of these things, and Royal Mail didn't like it. And so it's almost like, I mean, it is certainly in the past, the relationship between the media and the unions was pretty good, and the idea of, because you've said something to the press, you're going to get suspended from your job, this is unbelievable. And luckily the union are backing him. They've got a very good legal case. They've got their lawyers onto it. But this is just a bullying, isn't it?
Well, did you see Mick Lynch calling out the Radio 4 presenter this week on the Today programme, saying that in actual fact, you are just parroting the attack lines of the government and the Daily Mail and the Daily Express.
Well, to be fair, that's what journalists are supposed to do. They're supposed to put the opposite point of view when they're interviewing somebody, aren't they?
Well, Mick Lynch was pointing out that they've also got a duty of impartiality at the BBC. I mean, he wasn't being interviewed by the Daily Express or the Daily Mail.
The thing is, if the government are on, they'll probably get quite a hostile interview.
Well, that may be so, but Mick Lynch was came out punching and saying, look, these attack lines are not impartial attack lines. You're starting off with the presumption that we shouldn't be on strike and we've got to justify it. In actual fact, your job is to find out why we are on strike, and if people don't want us to be on strike, well, then you can interview somebody else for that. You're not interviewing me on that basis, are you?
Also, of course, you've got the train drivers' strike, RMT striking right the way around Christmas, which I to be honest with you, I think it's probably not such a good time to be striking. You want to try and make sure that people can get to see their loved ones over Christmas, and there aren't the problems that obviously that will cause if Boxing Day strike, Christmas Eve strikes, this sort of thing. I thought I'd have a good old look this week at something which, and if you're a subscriber to this programme, and you can do that if you're not already, just email me, tony@cultureshop.org.uk, and that email is up on our show page. You don't have to remember it, at thisweek.org.uk. And if you ask me, I will add you to our weekly circulation list. And this week, what I'll be circulating with that is the document which has come out from the Rail Maritime and Transport Union called The Roscoe Racket, Why It's Time to Take Control of UK Rolling Stock by the Rail Maritime and Transport Union. So this was put together about a year or so ago, but it looks at the, it's a brilliant little report, and it looks at the, it's not that long, it looks at these hidden companies. Now, the thing that annoys me about the Roscoes is that the transport correspondents, like Katie Austin, who actually worked on this dialect programme for a while, and suddenly, pow, she's BBC transport correspondent. She doesn't seem to know anything about the Roscoes, and they're certainly not talking about them. The Roscoes are in between the train operating companies and rail track in a way. So the rail track owns the rails underneath. That's nationalised. The train operating companies sell the tickets and employ the staff, but they have to lease these trains at a massive over-the-odds prices from the Roscoes, which are all owned by private equity firms, making an absolute fortune. And we never hear about them. And they're the real reason, I believe, why the fares are so high, number one. And number two, why they keep saying, oh, we can't afford to pay the railway workers. is because all of the profit from running the railways being creamed off by these private equity firms. The companies are called Porterbrook, Angel Trains, and Evershot. Those are the three big Roscoes, rolling stock companies. And I spoke to the former Assistant General Secretary of the Rail Maritime Transport Union about them earlier this week.
My name's Steve Headley. I'm the former Assistant General Secretary of the RMT. I started working in the railways when I was 19 for British Rail, and I went through the whole privatisation process. My job was a signalling engineer. I did electrical and mechanical work on signalling systems. So, that's where I kind of, that's my experience from the railway.
Now, privatisation is really in three sections. So we've got the train operating companies. These are the names that we know, such as First Great Western. We don't quite have a great... really are, but anyway, Arriva Trains, the rest of them. Then we've also got Network Rail, who operate and run the track and things like the overhead wires, this kind of thing. But there's another one, isn't there, we hardly ever hear about. In fact, the many of the TV, radio, newspaper transport correspondents never mention them.
Yeah, that's right. That's the rolling stock companies. Basically, there are three major ones. They take up about 87% of the leasing of trains to train operating companies. And basically, it's a racket. It's an absolute gold mine license to print money.
Can you just tell us why it is you think that we never hear about these companies?
It's a mystery to me. I think that part of the reason is it's people in influential places have got links with the companies that run them, and may even be shareholders, and they may be getting donations from these places. There are three major ones. One of them is Porterbrook, the other one's Angel Trains, and the other one's Evershot Investment. And they're all registered either in Luxembourg, Canada, or Australia to avoid paying taxes. Really, they're handing out outrageous dividends to their shareholders.
Can you give us an idea of how much, I mean, it's difficult to know exactly, obviously, how much they charge the train operating companies per train that they hire to them per day. But what about the, we can see a lot more by looking at their accounts and their dividends to their shareholders.
In the last 10 years, they paid out about $1.5 billion in shareholdings. So the dividends typically represent about 100% of their pre-tax profits. So that gives them this, they somehow that they're investing heavily in the rolling stock itself. They rent out the trains. The trains have a shelf life at a maximum of around 30 years. Some of them go longer than that. So it's in their interest to make those trains last as long as possible so they can rent them out to people, like the train operating companies. So we have all this money being given to shareholders. And we hear that there's no money for pay raises for railway workers and there's no money for safety on the railways.
So how did things used to work before the 1990s when railways were privatised?
Well, British Rail, which operated a combined service, really. It was in charge of all the rolling stock. It was in charge of all the what are now the train operating companies and the rail. It was one combined integrated system. And really, we didn't have the massive profiteering. It was a public company. It was very underinvested in the public company, to be fair, underfunded company. But what they did was provide a service. I think that if you look back in the 1980s, they won 2-5 trains. In some routes, travel faster, people are getting quicker to their destinations than they are today.
Well, another thing is, I can remember those days, and you had a lot more comfort and legroom.
Yeah, that's right. And people weren't just packed onto trains. The other thing was that these Roscoes have changed hands, and they generated about £3 billion. And the fact that they've been sold on to other companies, and those companies are continuing to profit from them as well. So all that money could have gone into the exchequer of the country and could have been used for to invest in public transport, to renew public transport.
One of the things that fascinates me about today and the road pricing that's going on, for example, anyone driving through London, this sort of thing, is there was a time, you know, I think it's probably fair to say up until the late 1960s, really, when people didn't expect to have a car because there was a cheap, reliable public transport service everywhere. And actually, if you look down those suburban streets, you maybe see 2 or 3 cars down the street. People didn't need it because there was a very cheap, reliable alternative.
Yeah, that's right. And we have, quite rightly, politicians are making noises about, public transport and reducing carbon emissions. The whole policy of privatisation is actually a deterrent to that because, even fuel prices are through the roof. It's probably cheaper to travel by a car or private vehicle. And the lack of public service, the lack of investment in the railways has meant that the rolling stock is tired and there's no incentive for the rolling stock companies to actually invest in that because they want to maximise their stock and run them down as far as they can, get the whole 30 years and perhaps more out of them. And we have a position where people are being forced into their cars, which is not good for the environment.
Not at all. And, you're reminding me of the whole situation in the United States in the 20s and 30s, where the road lobby got together, formed a company called National City Lines, which was Mack Truck. It was the Standard Oil, which was a massive Rockefeller-owned, vertically integrated, they owned everything from the oil wells right the way through to the petrol stations and gas stations, and deliberately ran the public transport down over there.
Yes, that's absolutely true, and I think that similar things are happening in Britain. One startling fact which I think people should be made aware of is during the pandemic, £14 billion was given to these private companies in the railway industry, and a massive proportion of that was given to the rolling stock companies who continued to pay out millions and millions of pounds to their shareholders. You've got this absolute racket where the government may as well just write the check to the shareholders. Why bother with the middleman?
Steve, you know the railways very well. It's difficult to estimate exactly, but what effect do you think it would have on pay and fares if the Roscoes were taken out of the equation and the profits that they're taking?
Let's look at 2020 financial year. The three major Roscoes, that's not including the smaller ones, paid out dividends of £950 million. £950 million. That to me is just outrageous. When the rest of the country is languishing in a pandemic, these people are paying out £950 million to their shareholders, which is coming directly from taxpayers through the government. So if that money was all invested in the railways, it would bring prices down massively. It would allow more staff on the railways. It would allow safer railways. And it would allow wages to keep pace with inflation on the railways and not having a demoralised, dejected staff, many of whom are now having to claim benefits. Many of the cleaner members had to claim benefits in order to survive.
Well, look, I mean, I'm going to go further and say I think it could possibly even halve the fares that passengers are paying too. And, of course, what would that mean? Well, it would mean that a lot of people would decide, I don't need my car, I'm going to leave my car at home, and it could lead to a kind of new golden age of rail.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think if all that money that's been paid out to shareholders and indeed the profits to the company itself were used to invest in the railway and the infrastructure, the infrastructure can be improved massively, and we could massively increase the number of people on the railways, and we could cut fares. And, you know, the money's there, it just needs to be used in the right way.
I know in the 1980s, Ken Livingstone was considering actually making public transport free in London. Do you think that's ever feasible?
Well, I think it should be. I mean, look, what we need to do is look at transport as a part of the greater economy of the country. If people are going to travel to different places, they're going to spend money in those places. And the model that's in use in Germany and France and Italy, people move for a fraction of the price that they move on British rails. So it actually helps the economy as a whole if people can get around cheaply or ideally for free. But that just is completely against the ethos of the Tory government. And dare I say it, the Starmerite government in waiting. I think that they aren't bold enough. They're not looking at an integrated economic policy. All they're looking for really is they pay out money to their friends that are making contributions to various political parties.
Can you just give listeners an idea of whereabouts they can look at some of these actually more enlightened ideas, which are an alternative to this, as I think you quite correctly describe, racket that there is nowadays in the railways, which isn't being talked about at all in the mainstream press?
Well, I think if you look on the any of the union websites or MTTS's or ASNEF websites, you will see this kind of stuff. And you will even see it in papers, like if you just search and you go on stuff like who owns the trains, and that gives a massive kind of evaluation of all the money that's been squandered on the rolling stock companies. If you look at some of the green, the environmental stuff right there, you look at the Green Party website or other environmental websites, it will tell you the need for a cheap public transport system and the benefits that will have to the environment in general. So I think that's where people really kind of need to look. Trade union websites, environmental websites that have correspondence that deal with transport.
Okay, Steve Headley, former Assistant General Secretary at the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much.
That was Steve Headley, as I said at the end there, from the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union. But I mean, I think what we're doing is we're drilling into the real essence of this, which is the racketeering. I mean, this really is a mob that have decided that, I mean, we've got the same obviously going on in the fuel, in the car, the diesel, the petrol market, and in the gas market, Martin, with the energy, big energy companies. We've got exactly the same going on in the railways. I wonder if this hadn't, John Major hadn't privatised the railways in 1994 as he did, and created this incredible, you know, unspoken about taboo organisation that's taking billions and billions out of the railways every year, doing absolutely nothing, just really sitting there and, well, I don't know, let's order another train. This train, you had it for so many years, why don't you now pay us this? Yeah. So they're not actually doing anything constructive, they just own the train. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, it may well be that if this energy price increase with gas, etc., and people, you know, for transport particularly, had happened, then we would now, everybody would be on the trains. People wouldn't be using cars if it wasn't for the Roscoes sitting in the way, creaming off the profits.
Well, it's a very egregious example of the things that are wrong with the whole philosophy of private everything in the first place. There is a very good reason why British Rail was created in the 1940s, because it makes sense to run it as an integrated system with the welfare goals built into it.
The BBC transport correspondent Katie Austin, who I work with here, I would guess the reason she never talks about the Roscoes is she doesn't know anything about them. It's a little bit beyond her. Simple as that.
Yes, and of course, very few people have got the interest to pursue all the details of exactly how it's being mismanaged.
Well, we will help everybody.
Many people are aware that it is being mismanaged, but what's extraordinary is that for many years, for example, in the Labour movement, the RMT and others were saying, well, we've got to renationalise the railways, and the sort of answer you got back from Blair and others was, well, it's not a priority. Yes, in principle, we probably would be in favour of putting them back in the public sector, but we don't want to spend any money on it. We've got other priorities. And then the banks collapse, and suddenly those money can be found for anything.
Well, the banks haven't collapsed, actually.
Well, didn't collapse because they were bailed out. But far more money was spent on that than would have been spent on renationalising the railway.
Quite right. And in fact, you wouldn't have to spend any money renationalising the railways.
No, because you just set the franchises back. That's right.
Exactly. Or you regulate, as you always say, Martin, quite smartly. All you do is you start to regulate these companies so they can't make any money anymore, so they have to give up their franchises. Very simple way to do it. So the report is called The Roscoe Racket, Why It's Time to Take Control of UK Rolling Stock by the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, 2019, I believe, early 2019 this report came out, and I will include that in the on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, but also attach it to the email I circulate this weekend relating to this programme. All three Roscoes experienced a wave of buying and selling in the years after privatisation. Angel Trains, which was originally bought for almost £700 million in 1996, was sold for £3.5 billion in 2015. So that's... over 20 years, that company has increased in price, let's see, five times in 20 years. So five times bigger, five times more value than, what's that, 500%. And similar with the other ones. They've been bought and sold by these big private equity firms, Martin, and making a fortune as well as the shareholders.
Well, that's right. It's a gravy train and you ain't on it. And... we should have dealt with all of this years ago, but of course it's on a ratchet. So once the stupid decisions have been taken, we're not allowed to discuss rescinding those stupid decisions, because apparently it's a fait accompli and we've just got to accept that that's the way of it. And it's the lack of ambition that there is. We've basically got used to accepting third and fourth rate, and there's no ambition to try and improve things. And that actually works as a sort of inertia that allows them to get away with what should have been banned years ago.
Well, I know, and in the background to all the strikes, so one of the reasons that the, particularly the rail workers, actually have got a tremendous amount of public support is because these train operating companies are operating.
John Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Prime Minister, a 3.5-hour journey takes 6 hours. A straight journey ends up with two changes and a diversion. A train is cancelled at short notice. This has become the experience of a West Coast rail passenger. Yeah. If Avanti do not get their act together, will the government cancel their franchise?
Yeah. Very popular question.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I thank my honourable friend for raising this, and I share the frustration that this is causing to many of his and other communities. Our priority immediately is to support the restoration of services before then making any long-term decisions on the operation of the West Coast franchise. But we will be closely monitoring Avanti's rollout of its recovery plan and holding them account for delivering for passengers.
Well, they're clearly not holding them to account. They've given them a second chance and they're muffing it already, Martin.
Well, that's right. I mean, you can't expect a change of direction from this government. I mean, they are wedded to a bankrupted ideology, which puts loads of money in the pockets of their supporters. So they're not going to change, are they?
And so let's have just a look at this general sort of thing about the cost of living crisis, because this is still with us, folks. And what about the Tory chaos this Christmas?
Dame Angela Riedel.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. This year the Tory party has given us 5 education secretaries, 4 chancellors, 3 prime ministers, 2 leadership coups. and Mr. Speaker, the partridges had to sell the pear tree to pay the gas. So, Mr. Speaker, isn't it the case that after a year of Tory chaos, incompetence and self-indulgence, the best Christmas present the Prime Minister could give to the British people is a general election?
Mr. Speaker, they're happier with that than before, Mr. Speaker. But all I'd say, when it comes to what the British people need this Christmas, Mr. Speaker, in order to ease the disruption on their lives, the best thing that the party opposite could do is tell their union bosses to call off these damaging strikes.
Doesn't really answer the question. Call off the strikes and then everyone will have a lovely Christmas because there won't be a cost of living crisis anymore.
Well, that's what you'd expect them to say. And, of course, they referred to union bosses there. The RMT is not affiliated to the Labour Party and nor is the Royal College of Nursing. They don't give a penny to the Labour Party. So the Labour Party's got no influence over them whatsoever.
Completely ridiculous. So, anyway, what do you think about the cost of living crisis? Is there any sort of silver bullet?
Well, the cost of living crisis is a symptom of the underlying crisis of capitalism, which is not going to be wished away. And
isn't it just an after effect of all the Thatcherite privatisations? It was kind of bound to come. You know, it's taken a few decades to happen, but now the government doesn't actually have a say anymore because they don't own these things.
Well, that's true, but I think the inflation that we've had recently is not caused by excessive wage demands. There's no case for that whatsoever. In fact, real wages have been falling for a generation, so certainly that isn't what's caused it.
Energy prices going up.
It's energy prices going up, which is to do with the geopolitics and all the rest of it. You know, it's Putin to blame, blah, 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 except, of course, it isn't. It's your sanctions on Putin and on Russia, which have caused the problem. And the modern capitalist setup since 2008 cannot tolerate any inflation in general prices. Yeah, so they've relied upon cheap goods coming in from China to keep prices down, and they've relied on credit to keep people able to buy stuff, so that you can buy stuff on the never never. All of which was not how capitalism was supposed to work, but they've managed to engineer a model that kind of works. But what, and of course, it will allow things like massive property bubbles to develop. They're considered positive. House prices rising, good. Prices in the shops rising, bad. We need increases in wages, real increases in wages, and the deflation of the asset price bubbles, which means that the wealthy classes who've done so well out of Thatcherism need to lose their money, and the other working classes who've done badly need a massive wage increase, which they can then spend in the shops and get the economy moving. And it's we're reaching the point where something's got to give, and it's not necessarily going to be the workers this time. It's going to have to be the bosses, isn't it?
You and I do disagree a bit on Prime Minister's questions. I mean, of course, it's a bit of a bun fight, but I think that some of the MPs do occasionally bring up really interesting points at PMQs, and they make the Prime Minister wriggle a bit to answer them. And one of them, I think, who's been particularly appalling over the last few years is this guy Ian Blackford, who was the leader of the SNP, and finally the SNP have got their finger out and replaced him. I just found his questions, so he was always trying to sort of guilt trip and trying to come up with, but he just came across as so sort of dour and pompous. Anyway, they've got a new guy at the SNP now. He's just taken over from Blackford. His name's Stephen Flynn. So let's see how he got on with his two questions to Rishi Sunak this week.
Mr. Speaker, thanks to positive and proactive negotiations between the Scottish Government and Unite and Unison Health Unions, a pay settlement has been reached and strike action averted. Yep. By stark contrast, the UK Health Secretary appears completely unwilling to negotiate with unions on pay, and strike action is very much still on the table. Shame. So may I ask the Prime Minister, when will he see the error of his ways and follow the Scottish Government's lead?
Yeah. Prime Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm glad the UK Government was able to provide £1.5 billion in extra funding to the Scottish Government for public services. The Health Secretary and other ministers have engaged fully, not just with the unions, but with an independent pay-setting process, which takes the politics out of the process and ensures that we can meet those independent requirements with a fair pay deal.
Stephen Flynn!
Mr. Speaker, let's be clear, those words will ring hollow in the ears of those people who, unlike the Prime Minister, can't nip into Waitrose for their shopping, nor indeed even turn on their heating at this moment in time. And that's particularly true for people in Scotland, because as we know, average energy bills in Scotland are not anticipated to be £2,500 per year. They're expected to be £3,300 per year. People are genuinely terrified, and that's despite the fact that Scotland produces 6 times more gas than we consume, with some 80% of our electricity coming from low-carbon sources. Decades of failed UK energy and regulatory policy coming home to roost. Is it not the case that Scotland has the energy? We just need the power.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm glad the Honourable Gentleman raised the question of energy support. And it's because of the actions of this government that we are providing every household in this country with around £900 of support with their energy bills this winter, £55 billion worth of support. And on top of that, next year, there will be extra cost of living payments worth up to £1,200 for the most vulnerable, whether that's those on means-tested benefits, pensioners, or indeed disabled. This is a government that will always look after the most vulnerable in our society.
So that's Stephen Flynn, his first go. I think he did a lot better than Ian Blackford normally does, Martin, and also making this fascinating point that, well, we're not having this nursing strike up in Scotland because the Scottish government's dealt with the problem, negotiated and settled.
Yes, and it's a fair point, although, of course, what Rishi Sunak comes back with is because of the Barnett formula, there is more public expenditure per head in Scotland than there is in the UK as a whole. But, of course, the SNP then say, yes, but then you took all of the North Sea oil profits and we didn't see any of those. If we'd been an independent country, we'd have had all of that. So that's sort of the sort of thing that they're sparring about. The energy market in this country should never have been privatised. It's quite simple. Just shouldn't have happened. It did happen. And, of course, what Rishi Sunak is actually doing is he's giving the private monopolies which control the energy industry a subsidy from the taxpayer. Yeah? So although people are being given £900 to pay their bills, that money is being taken off them in taxes to give to the energy companies, which are already making a massive profit, which is obviously where you ought to get the money from. And the obvious thing to do is just take the money off them and nationalise them. And you know, in some parts of the world, that's what would happen, but not this one. And that the Tories are making a virtue of giving these private monopolies taxpayers' money. But that's not the way to do it, is it? That's just a silly way to do it. And it's ultimately, of course, it's going to mean that people's real living standards will have to fall in order to pay for that. And that will therefore constrain the economy going forward and you won't be able to make it run at full capacity.
So the National Grid has suddenly scrapped backup plan as Britain battles a sub-zero freeze this week. National Grid has already warned that it may have to implement planned blackouts this winter if the UK fails to shore up enough energy imports from Europe. National Grid has cancelled an emergency backup plan after it put 2 coal units on standby amid plummeting temperatures to ensure the UK does not plunge into darkness as snow blankets the country. 2 of the grid's operators' reserve coal-fired power stations were given notice as the network faces huge surge in demand amid this current cold snap, which is set to last until the end of next week. And I think the way the forecast is, I heard it, is that we're going to have a little bit of warmth over the weekend, so things will warm up a little bit, and it's going to get cold again next week. Parts of Britain have endured temperatures as low as minus 10. In fact, it's gone even lower now, hasn't it? With health chiefs encouraging people to heat their homes. Now, you know, it's all very well encouraging people to heat their homes, but they can't necessarily afford it. And what this is saying here is, without these coal-fired power stations, Martin, the lights would have been going out.
Well, I don't see any end to this in the near future, because there's no chance of any negotiated solution in the Ukraine. And as a result of that, they've said that they're not going to buy Russian gas at more than $60 a therm or whatever it is. And the Russians said, well, in that case, we're not selling you any gas at all. Now, in other words, that's going to push the spot price for gas and oil through the roof. And there's no solution to that because they don't want to negotiate, so they're not going to negotiate. So they're going to have to go to the electorate whenever they do go to the electorate and say, in actual fact, the economy, they're predicting there's going to be a 2-year recession and that we will come out of it at the other end of that. I would suggest to you that once we go into recession, it's going to turn into a depression, which will not be stopped until we completely change the economic policy, which there's no prospect of in the short run.
But the poor are being ground into the dirt, surely. I mean,
well, they
basically,
are, yes.
Yeah. I mean, anyway, let's have a listen to, this isn't quite the phrase which was used. In Wales, what's happened is the local authority has managed things such that they have created reserves so that they have got emergency payments, hardship payments, that anybody in around the that lives around near Caerphilly in Wales can just simply come to the council and say, look, I just cannot afford to heat my home, this kind of thing. I can't afford the petrol to get to work. And then the council has put together a £3 million hardship grant to pay that money. Now, of course, nothing like that is happening in Bristol. The money goes on other things like Bristol Energy, or it doesn't anymore, but it did, or the mayor's trips around the world to talk about global warming. So anyway, here's PMQs, another little clip from PMQs where we hear about the Welsh, who local authority has done the sensible thing and set aside £3 million for people that can't afford to pay the bills.
Chris Evans.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. Caerphilly County Borough Council recently announced a £3 million cost of living hardship fund to help those most in need in Islington and across our county borough. Does the Prime Minister think it's right that local authorities are forced to cover the costs of 12 years of economic mismanagement by this Tory government?
Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, what the Honourable Gentleman fails to acknowledge is that because of the actions of this UK government, not only are we supporting people in Wales and across the United Kingdom with help with our energy bills, we've also provided £1.2 billion of extra funding for the Welsh Government to use to give to local authorities to support their constituents, and he would do well to acknowledge the benefits of the United Kingdom and the actions of the UK government.
Well, I presume that that was a Plaid Cymru question, from the way in which Rishi Sunak answered. So,
You can't presume. It may have been a Labour.
Well, it may have been Labour. It was unlikely to be a Tory question, wasn't it? Well, I mean, the distribution of resources.
Do the Tories have any MPs in Wales?
They do, yes.
One or two. But yeah, not Caerphilly.
They don't have any. No. I think Caerphilly probably is Plaid. But anyway, what local authorities are forced to do if they want to try and help people is to try and, you know, come up with some kind of solutions to try and help people on a day-to-day basis. But, of course, the local authorities have been denuded of all resources, right, not least by the transfer to the community charge from the rates and all the rest of it, and the blatant manipulation of standing.
But surely this is something which Cameron brought in, was this slow reduction in the funding from central government or local government.
Yes.
The idea is to just take away their power.
Well, that's
to do anything.
And of course, what it means is that the opposition, the Labour opposition or Plaid Cymru opposition, are then forced to carry out cuts, which then make them unpopular. Meanwhile, the central government pretends that it's nothing to do with it, even though in fact, it's them that's made the decision to cut the expenditure, and if you remember, Rishi Sunak boasted during the Tory internal election that he had diverted funds from inner city areas to Tunbridge Wells, because he thought that Tunbridge Wells were being hard done by. He was speaking in Tunbridge Wells to Tunbridge Wells Conservatives, and he made it clear that he'd done what he could to make sure that money didn't go to deprived areas of Britain, but it went to Tunbridge Wells instead. Now, that is the politics of the Conservative Party, the modern Conservative Party. We look after our own and everybody else can go and take a running job.
Well, yes, the cost of living crisis. I did an article back in May this year for Levellers Day in Oxfordshire, which is a commemoration of the murder of two, execution by Oliver Cromwell, two Leveller soldiers in the town, about the cost of living crisis. saying that if we really want to fix this cost of living crisis, we need to address this problem of rents and housing. It seems to be at the, why is housing so, it's sort of at the heart of so much of this cost of living crisis, Martin? Because the rents and house prices are through the roof. And yet, I mean, maybe sort of 20 years ago, people could kind of afford to pay the rent. Nowadays, this is just it becomes like extortion. If you compare what people are paying in mortgage repayments or rent to the actual cost that it costs to build a house, what people are paying something like between 10 and 50 times more. You know, the house lasts maybe 100 years or something. People are paying an absolute fortune, and it is a racket. And as you've said many times on this program, the housing benefits just simply go to subsidize Tory voting buy-to-let landlords.
Well, I mean, you put your finger on it. It's because it's a manipulation of the economic system to benefit the insiders who already have assets. And, in the 1920s, because of the advance of the Labour Party and the creation of, you know, council housing by the local government in London and so on, they decided that they were going to try and encourage people to buy their own houses by effectively not taxing capital gains on buying houses. And this led to successive property bubbles in the southeast of England. And then, of course, because you've got a property bubble and inflation starts to rise, you then have to raise interest rates to bring the inflation down. And every time you do that, you lose more enterprises north of the Wash that were dependent upon low interest rates in order to function. So that, it's not only that it's unfair, it's also deindustrialized the country. It's much easier to invest money in bricks and mortar, whether you're a buy-to-let landlord or the Duke of Westminster.
Or HSBC.
Than to innovate and to develop new companies with new products.
Yeah.
And that's why Britain has slipped down the
league
table.
Isn't it interesting? Maybe by getting rents down and mortgages down to a much more realistic level, an affordable level, the country might be able to re-industrialise. People would be able to, you know, we'd actually be able to produce things here. Anyway, we've got three clips, I think it is, about the housing crisis before the break, which is a little bit late this week, but as usual. But anyway, so let's have a little look at housing now. And Prime Minister's questions, a couple of times it came up there too.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, it is now well over 3 years since the Conservatives promised the end no-fault evictions. Enfield has the highest rate of Section 21 evictions in London. 30 families in my constituency in the last month alone were made homeless as a result of Section 21. I have families sat in my office trying to keep warm as we try to find them emergency accommodation. Will the Prime Minister scrap this shameful legislation? If so, when?
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Lady will know that we have announced plans to do that and we await parliamentary time. But it's not the only thing we are doing to protect renters, Mr. Speaker. We have passed legislation already to protect tenants from rip-off fees, and we've capped holding deposits because we want to make sure that renters do have the protections that they require and they have their decent homes to rent.
Well, the fact that the Tories have decided that they do need to bring some legislation to protect people who rent is a sign of the times.
Oh, but there's no parliamentary time for it, I'm afraid, no. Dear boy.
Well, in any case, the point I would make is that the danger with trying to regulate the private rented market as it currently constituted is that a lot of people, and this is probably what's going to happen, is as we go into this depression that I was talking about earlier, the buy-to-let landlords are simply going to sell the houses because they need to cover their debts. And then everybody in those buy-to-let houses, like me, will be kicked out. This is what happened in 2008. The guy who owned all the houses that I lived in, and he owned hundreds of properties over Bristol, he went bust and everybody was evicted. So that what we really need is a council house sector. Yeah, we should have been building council houses, or not necessarily building. You could buy existing stock and rent it out as council housing.
Can't we have some sort of a national bank to do that? At the moment, what's happening is HSBC are rubbing their hands. All these distressed assets—they want to buy them up and become the biggest landlord in Britain.
Yeah, well, I mean, what the banks do in this country is they lend on real estate, and that's what they've always done. And if you're trying to set up an innovative business, you cannot get money from the banks. I mean, the Midland Bank was originally set up in the Midlands as a kind of rebellion against the domination by the City of London of lending in this country. And it's, you know, it's money for old rope to lend on a rising property market. Why go to the bother of having to investigate new businesses with new products and new ideas when all you've got to do is buy another skyscraper?
Well, as I said earlier, they seem to be quite happy to lend money, even if you never pay it back, for human genetic engineering, these weird kind of things. Anyway, another little look at Prime Minister's questions on housing.
Sir Olney.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. As temperatures are plummeting and the cost of living crisis is deepening, ordinary families are facing a Dickensian nightmare across the country this Christmas. Mortgage bills are soaring, household repossessions are up, and nearly 500,000 tenants face a threat of eviction after falling behind on their rent. Too many people are worrying about where they and their children will wake up on Christmas morning. So will the Prime Minister agree to a temporary ban over the festive period on repossessions and evictions so that nobody has to live in fear of losing their home this Christmas?
Mr. Speaker, we provide a range of support to both homeowners and tenants who are in difficulty already. But the most important thing we are doing to financially support them through the winter is by providing almost £900 of support with their energy bills, on top of all the additional support for those who are most vulnerable, including pensioners. That demonstrates the actions of this government to help the country get through what we acknowledge is a challenging time.
Well, I come back to what I said earlier. This £900, which he's giving people, is going to be given to the energy companies. I bought £40 on my key.
Do you want to give us an update on that?
It was indeed my key. So I got a new key and I put £40 on it. But that lasted a week. It's gone in a week.
And this is electrical heating,
yes,
isn't it?
And that's gone straight to EDF. So I was kept warm for the week, but I didn't make any money out of it. The people who made the money were Electricité de France, who supply my electricity. And ultimately, of course, this money is going to be paid for by the taxpayer. Now, what we should have done is taken the money off Electricité de France or whoever it was who was, you know, if these energy companies were in the public sector, you just reduce their profit margin and that's the way you
get
the paper.
We're going to be hearing a bit about EDF from David Halpin after the break. But finally, on housing, ITV News did an excellent report on social housing horrors. This week, they seem to be the best people to go to if you're having an awful situation with your housing. What they've noticed, Martin, and maybe you could, before we hear, you could just give us an idea why this might be, is there's been an enormous increase in the social housing, that is the housing associations, problems with their housing. In this case, for example, we hear various things, including that they've just got this constant rush of water coming from the flat above or from the pipes above their house that the housing association doesn't seem to want to deal with at all. So, you know, this is just coming into their house, great loads of water pouring into the house.
Well, that's because it shouldn't be run by housing associations. It should be run by the local council, and it should be run by the government, local government, directly. Housing associations, you used to be on the board of Knightstone, have become for-profit organisations. So they don't want to spend money on repairs and all the rest of it.
That's right. They've completely changed the respect that they have for the tenants. They now call them customers, which is a bit of a joke. You know, obviously you've only got one landlord. You can't go around and shop around. And they don't come and do the repairs. And if they do, they're not done properly. They have to come back. So by having farmed out the repair services to various different organisations, the company themselves, the housing association themselves, got absolutely no control over whether a repair gets done properly or at all. So let's have a listen to this ITV report before the break.
After the water comes the panic. As Gemma and her two sons fear what will happen next.
Mum, just cut through some of the sockets.
In their South London flat, they scramble for towels and buckets, catching what they can from their ceiling-turned sieve. But this isn't the first time. Far from it.
So it's leaked around 12 times. This, to this extent, 3 times.
my lights and electrics just blew while my children were here. That put them in pure panic because that was really scary. Like, I literally needed to get my children out. The children waiting outside were in pure panic because obviously mum's in here. They understand electric and water, what it can do.
Almost 2 months before this latest leak, Gemma warned her housing association, Peabody, that it was starting again. She feared the ceilings would collapse. And then they did.
I was there and this came crashing down. This came at such a force. It was so hard, it literally took my intercom straight off my wall.
How would you describe how you've been treated by Peabody?
You smile when you want to ask you that. Is that a ridiculous question?
Yeah, because it's happened 3 times and they haven't done anything. They've not kept us safe as their tenants. That's what we pay our rent for.
ITV News has found the number of complaints made about housing associations and councils to the Ombudsman has gone up by 63% in the last year to 16,289. Some landlords have seen much bigger increases than others. These are the 5 most complained about housing associations. L&Q are top of the list, followed by Clarion. But Peabody has seen the biggest jump of any, with a 123% rise in complaints. Peabody told us their numbers have increased due to better publicity around how tenants can complain. There are also tenants who don't go to the Ombudsman, who still have disrepairs. When we meet Aisha, she's living in a hotel in London with her children. Their journey here has been nothing short of a nightmare. In February, she awoke to police officers smashing down the door of her neighbour's flat in Peckham. Aisha and others had for months reported a terrible smell coming from Sheila Celioni's home, but Peabody didn't check. Inside, police found Miss Celioni's body, badly decomposed. She'd been dead for 2.5 years.
I was smelling it for months. I was getting maggots, blue bottle flies. As soon as the police ran inside, they ran back outside. I have never seen police look scared.
Aisha requested to be moved, and in November, the family were given a home in Brixton.
Well, you could really smell it.
But on the day they moved in, it leaked.
And when I opened the door, it was raining inside of the baby's bedroom, on the baby. It could have got so wet up there that the roof could have just went bang on my baby. He's only 18 months old.
And when they tried to leave the house, the door was jammed shut.
In the event of any fires or any incidents, we'll not be able to get out of this front door.
How would you describe how they've treated you?
On a scale of 1 to 10, it's about a minus 10. That's how bad it's been.
We contacted Peabody. They said, our job is to put things right when they go wrong, and all of our residents should expect issues dealt with promptly. They say they're working hard to resolve the issues raised and are really sorry for the inconvenience caused to Gemma and Aisha. Gemma has now been moved to temporary accommodation, but is still waiting for a permanent home. Aisha has now left the hotel and is back at the home that leaked. Peabody don't know what caused it. For her, the nightmare isn't over. Daniel Hewitt, News at 10.
Martin, what we're hearing there is an absolute travesty, isn't it, really? The idea that people are supposed to pay to live in these places, which the housing associations are just, in this case Peabody, just simply taking the rent and doing nothing for it, it seems.
Yes, and I bet you there's even worse stories from the completely private sector. And an element of this is, oh, well, housing associations have failed, so we're going to have to move, you know, towards more, even more privatised provision than previously. A lot of this housing stock was originally owned by the local councils. The best stuff was sold off to the tenants as a fraction of its real value, and what they get left with is the stuff that's not much use and nobody really wants it. And of course, again, housing associations have become for-profit organisations, so they will actually, they're not there just to look after the tenants.
Well, a housing association is supposed to be a halfway house between council, government-owned housing and private landlords.
Well, in other words, yes, but I mean the point is that this is the third way, isn't it? In actual fact, when people who are council tenants in Bristol were asked years ago whether they wanted to go to an arm's-length management organisation, an ALMO, or a Housing Action Trust, a HAT. They overwhelmingly said they wanted to remain council tenants, and that's why you've still got quite a lot of council tenants in Bristol, because they just refused to be transferred to a housing association. But the whole philosophy of New Labour and the Conservatives is to get rid of public housing. Public housing was regarded by the Conservatives as a Labour vote. You know, people who got given council housing after the war were grateful for it, because it was often of higher standard than what they'd had before, and they also knew that they couldn't be evicted and they had security of tenure. That's all gone, and it's gone quite deliberately, because from a Conservative point of view, these people just become Labour voters automatically. Whereas if you sell the houses to them at a fraction of what it cost them to build, and lots of people took advantage of that, but that's free money given to people to convert them from Labour to Conservative. And of course that money was public money, which could have been spent on improving the general housing stock. But it went to individuals instead, many of whom made a lot of money. I mean, in London, I've been stayed in what used to be council flats, where people were able to retire, having sold it on to the private market, for millions of pounds of you know, what used to be a public asset.
As we come up to Christmas, I think it would be quite a nice idea this year to do a bit of a, like, not a poetry competition exactly, but we've had some poetry sent in by Patrizia Opulenza, who's done this before, actually one, I think. But anyway, here's her poem about Christmas for us this year. It's a Christmas ode to Not the BCFM News. Christmas is a-coming. Tony's getting fat. Martin needs a penny on his lecky in his flat. Martin, with his dodgy key, was cold, fed up and tired, but still this trooper got on board with TG to have his say, but sounded rather meek and mild, not his usual BCFM way. Christmas is a time for love to all God's people who perhaps are lost and in a mess, needing a kindly word or two. Where'er we go, we take ourselves, so let goodness shine forth and see. A smile, a nod, a kind word to all, a rare gift you give for free. Henceforth, this be your purpose to those you meet upon the way, for we never know what's going on inside each heart today. So, happy Christmas, dearest listeners. Blessings to TG, MS, DB and guests who make for easy listening of time well spent. The best. So that's Patrizia Opulenza, her contribution. We've also had another contribution from Ian Jenkins. He's quite prolific on Twitter, and here's his poem.
They were allowing us Christmas this year with only some moderate fear. We can party all night, but we can't afford lights. They were allowing us Christmas this year. They were allowing us Christmas this year. No lockdown to dampen the cheer. We would gobble down turkey, but they've got the bird lurgy. They were allowing us Christmas this year. They were allowing us Christmas this year. We could go to the pub for a beer, but the local shut down and there's no bus to town. They were allowing us Christmas this year. They were allowing us Christmas this year. No need to be shedding a tear, except for Aunt Pat, who froze in her flat. They were allowing us Christmas this year. They were allowing us Christmas this year. We'll share it with those we hold dear. If there's riots and looting, we can always blame Putin. They were allowing us Christmas this year. They were allowing us Christmas this year. And their plans are now horribly clear. To fill us with drugs and make us eat bugs. Still, at least we get Christmas this year. They were allowing us Christmas this year. They must think that their triumph is near. But we'll laugh and we'll live. And we'll never forgive the things done to us these past few years. They were allowing us Christmas this year, so let's make it count, do you hear? But can anyone say who they are anyway to decide what we do any year?
Thank you. The whole season's covered, thank you. Gordon Tawney's Festival Overture, The Joy of Christmas, with the RTÉ Concert Orchestra.
From Tuesdays in Tune on Radio 3, Gordon Thornett, Thornett, Festive Overture, The Joy of Christmas. Welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. For those that want to bypass the psycho in the corner, on the new talkradio.org.uk stream, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, as well as at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Latest on Ukraine, Martin. Any thoughts on that? Because the Americans are doing everything they possibly can to. They're now talking about $858 billion. The Senate wants. It's something called the National Defence Authorization Act, NDAA, and a vote of 83 to 11, the spending bill for $858 billion, yes, that's $858 billion, has already been approved by the House and now heads to President Biden's desk for his signature.
Well, a lot of it is going to go missing, as we obviously know, and it may well be that some of the Republicans who are now in control of the Congress are going to start asking questions about where this money's all gone. But I don't think they're going to ask too many questions, because a lot of it has come back as kickbacks to people in the US, which is what the whole game is.
Well, one of the
and
things,
of course, people inside the Ukraine have made quite a lot of money out of this as well.
I don't know if you picked this up, but the Americans are saying, well, we're having trouble tracing. We think quite a lot of the equipment that we're giving to the Ukrainians and some of the money may be going missing, so we're going to have to send US troops over to keep an eye on it.
Well, obviously, they're in a bind because they can't win. The Ukrainians can't win. There was an interview on in The Economist this week with Zelensky and a couple of his generals, and the level of delusion is enormous. The game now being played is to keep Western public opinion on side so that the money train can continue. But on the battlefield itself, everything is really, you know, not going the way of the West at all. And it's extraordinary the way that you get, you know, the head of the British Army and various other people saying that the Ukrainians are winning. There's no evidence of that whatsoever. And, you know, the Russians are basically doing what they said they were going to do, and there's not a lot that anybody can do to stop them.
So American troops over in Ukraine. We also heard this week in the Daily Mail about
already.
British. Royal Marines have taken part in high-risk covert operations in Ukraine. General reveals for the first time. Lieutenant General Robert Magawan said Marines went to Ukraine before and after the invasion. Well, maybe that's why the Russians invaded. He said they then operated a hugely sensitive environment with high level of risk. Yeah, because it's illegal. You shouldn't be there. What are you doing there? Royal Navy spokesperson told Royal Mail Online that Marines did not serve any combat function. Royal Marines were deployed in Ukraine, involved in discrete operations and performed tasks.
Well, the Russians have openly accused the Royal Navy of blowing up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is quite extraordinary for them to do that, but I presume that they have the sufficient information to say that that's who they think did it. Now, that's disappeared down the memory hole here, but you could, if the Russians had a different kind of leadership, they might say, right, well, it's now time for us to blow up some pipelines supplying gas or electricity, gas or oil from the North Sea. Yeah? Tit for tat, you're having a bit of a crisis in terms of energy supplies, but we could blow up your pipeline and put your people.
So what were they doing there before the invasion, I wonder?
Well, they've been there since 2014. Don't forget that the sniper attack in the Maidan Square that killed 80-odd people, including six officers, was carried out by a NATO-orchestrated death squad from Georgia. Now, those people won't be operating on their own. They will be working with British Special Forces. British Special Forces seem to have been involved in the assassination of Zakhachenko
in
2018.
Martin, according to Ben Wallace, they're there to help deliver weapons and also to do a bit of training.
Well, they've been doing more than that.
Help deliver weapons. I mean,
The British Special Forces...
I suppose they're trying to make sure that these weapons actually
British
do go
Special
to the front
Forces
line.
Have played a particularly pernicious role in all of this. I think they were involved in the assassination of Zakhachenko, Givi and Motorola. Givi and Motorola were paramilitary leaders. Zakhachenko was the elected Prime Minister of the Donetsk Republic, killed in a car bomb. That's got British Special Forces fingerprints all over.
They serve no combat function.
Well, that's just... That's what they would say. But, I mean, it's also come out this week that the SAS are going to be properly investigated over the 57 unexplained deaths in Afghanistan, where they went round just killing people out of hand. Now, that is what British Special Forces do.
So what was the purpose of that, killing out of hand?
I think in that particular case, the Special Forces culture within the British, Australian and US Special Forces was one of, we go around and kill locals because, you've got to be bloodied up, yeah? So as soon as you arrive, you've got to
training,
go out and kill a local
so
that you've got the balls for it.
Getting people used to actually killing, so you actually give them someone to kill. Well, the actual effect is going to be, it's going to really enrage the locals, particularly, say, for example, the brothers and sisters of people you've killed, and they're going to join the Taliban.
That's right, and of course, ultimately, this has been exposed...
Creating a conflict.
This has been exposed because military police have exposed it, because in actual fact... if you allow your special forces to do things like that, you are definitely going to lose the war. And hey, what happened? You lost the war. So all the money, all the bloodshed, all ultimately, of course, these SAS guys, if they were doing this, should go to prison and life should mean life. Yeah, that's how serious it is. And if you're going to accuse the Russian armed forces of carrying out atrocities in Ukraine, if it turns out that it's your armed forces that carried out those atrocities, and that includes the senior leadership of your armed forces, must stand trial, as happened with many of the senior military leaders from Yugoslavia. Now, if you're not prepared to do that, then you're not serious.
Okay,
and
so
somebody may say, well, if you're not going to put them on trial, we're going to go round to the house where they live and we're going to sort them out for
you. Well, there was a by-election in Manchester this week, which Labour won, and none of the candidates wanted to answer any questions about Ukraine, Martin.
Well, that's because, presumably, I would imagine in this particular case, because they don't really know anything about it, everybody's been told, oh, yes, it's the evil Putin, blah-de-blah-de-blah, but when it comes down to it and you ask them basic questions like, who was the president of Ukraine before Zelensky, they'll go, bah, 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 and they don't know anything about it.
Well, they don't, no, but it's interesting, isn't it, that he simply refused to reply. Anthony Weber, he's been pressing them, all the candidates, only one or two actually did reply. These are the minor candidates, none of the four main parties, the Labour, Conservative, Lib Dem or Green, would reply to him, even though he sent them three requests, please, will you give us your position on Ukraine? And so when I spoke to Anthony earlier this week, he explained why he thinks that it's important to ask these questions as an individual, as the sort of thing we do on this show, to these candidates. Why bother? Because, you know, I asked him, what are you doing this for? Why ask about Ukraine?
In the past, there were Upper Hustings meetings where all the candidates were invited and had the equal chance to put their views forward and answer questions. Now what happens is the main parties seem to gang together and have these very small Hustings meetings where they don't allow or they don't invite the other candidates to come along, which I personally think is pretty disgraceful. But the problem with these sort of meetings is very controlled in the sort of questions which are asked. So they basically don't have any difficult questions. So I thought, well, what is the major issue which is causing the cost of living rise at the moment and the inflation situation? And that is the government's policies on Ukraine and Russia, and the fact that because they've been sanctioning Russia, that's actually gone against the government in terms of it's created an energy crisis, because if we have our government cut the country off from key energy supplies and do that alongside other countries, then it's going to mean that the energy supplies which are available in the world are much more expensive, which is what has happened. But what I wanted to do was find out if any of the nine candidates in this by-election had a different point of view, because I was aware that all of the candidates of the main parties broadly supported the government's line on Ukraine and Russia, which is basically pouring money into the Ukraine, the President Zelensky government, and with no reference at all to having permission from the electorate.
So that's Anthony Weber there, speaking to me earlier this week. I just thought, is it fascinating to see six candidates who wouldn't respond, and he says they enter the Hall of Shame. I remember I used to call them the City Slackers here in Bristol because they refused to come on this programme. Emily Carter Candola, who's a Conservative candidate, Anna Fryer, the Liberal Democrat candidate, Daniel Jerome, the Green Party, Paul Swansborough, Reform Party, Andrew Weston, the Labour Party, and Julian Yvonne, a Social Democratic Party. None of them would respond to his question about Ukraine. But one lady actually did respond.
There's a large number of candidates and people in office who get away with not responding to questions and have done for years. And personally, I think something should be done about that in terms of expected standards that the electorate requires of a candidate and a politician. But anyway, on to the responses. The first one was from Christina Glancy of the Freedom Alliance Party, and she said, Andy, thank you for the letter. My comments and those of the Freedom Alliance are: the Ukraine war is a conflict deliberately manufactured by the NATO allies for the purpose of creating an inflationary crisis which will further impoverish their own populations, destitute people are more willing to submit to state control, and control is very much the sole objective of the globalist parasites and their captive governments in the UK and elsewhere. I do not underestimate the very real suffering that is occurring in eastern Ukraine and the autonomous regions. Unfortunately, the British media cannot be relied upon to accurately or impartially report on the conflict. Ideally, MPs from all parties would be able to see through the propaganda and pressurise the government to bring this new conflict to an end. But relying on existing MPs to act with anything approaching integrity, independence and intelligence is an absurd fantasy. I support the concept of asking the British people via a referendum whether our nation should adopt a neutral position on the conflict.
So that was Christina Glancy from this Freedom Alliance Party. You can find online, not actually very easy to find on search engines for some funny reason, but it's called freedomalliance.co.uk. Now, this word freedom is kind of abused, Martin, as well, isn't it? But, I mean, that's a pretty good response. Reiterating and repeating what he's saying there. You know, he's saying, well, I support the concept of asking for a referendum on whether Britain should adopt a neutral position in the Ukraine conflict, for example. This is way, way distant from anything that's being discussed by our parliamentarians, and including on the television too.
Well, I don't think it's a particularly realistic demand. But on the other hand, the sentiment behind it, I totally agree with. I mean, Britain has played a pernicious role in fomenting this conflict, not least when our then Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, turned up in April in Kiev when a negotiation was taking place between Kiev and the Russian government based in Ankara in Turkey, in Istanbul. In fact, it was taking place, sorry, Ankara is the capital. And a possibility of a negotiated solution was on the table, and Boris Johnson ruled it out and told Zelensky that if he did negotiate a deal with the Russians, the British wouldn't accept it.
So let's have a look.
And so the British have basically played the role of fighting to the last Ukrainian.
So
here,
what's the Labour Party doing about it? Well, let's have a listen.
Mr. Speaker, this is our final PMQs of the year. So I hope you will part... Oh, really? I hope you will... Mr. Speaker, what I was going to say was I hope you will pass on all of our thanks, at least on this side, to all those who kept our house and our democracy working. Yeah. And I want to finish this year thinking about our friends in Ukraine. As a result of Putin's barbaric assault on their freedom, millions will spend Christmas in sub-zero temperatures without heating, electricity or hot water. Their suffering is unimaginable, but their bravery is awe-inspiring. So will the Prime Minister join me in saying that whatever other difficulties and disagreements we have across this dispatch box, we are and will remain united in our unwavering support for Ukraine's freedom, its liberty and its victory.
Yeah. Prime Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, can I join with the Honourable Gentleman in thanking and paying tribute to all the staff of the House for the fantastic work that they do to support all of us. And I appreciate his comments on Ukraine. It's been a point of incredible unity across this House and indeed the country, something that we can all be proud of in our country, that we have stood behind Ukraine at its hour of need. And as I said yesterday, this Christmas, many families will be laying an extra place at their Christmas table, and that speaks to the generosity and compassion of our nation, and long may that continue.
Yes, but what he's not saying is that actually the lot of the money for these Ukrainian refugees is actually running out, Martin, isn't it?
It is, and I think it's very depressing to see the establishment there, which is what we're talking about, the leader of the opposition and the Prime Minister, just reiterating the lies, really, about what's happened in the Ukraine. The war in the Ukraine started in 2014.
What annoys me more than anything is he's saying, oh, our wonderful, healthy democracy, a bit of backslapping. And then he's going on about how there's not going to be any discussion about Ukraine because it's a great sovereign country, which it isn't. It's controlled by the Central Intelligence Agency. And we're just backing them. There's no discussion about this at all in this so-called democracy. Of course, it's not a democracy at all.
Well, I would agree with that, and I think it's very significant that there is no serious opposition to what's going on. And I think the
Is it a dictatorship then?
Well, no, what you've got is the oligarchy in the West has made up its mind what it's doing here, and they're all aligned up. I mean, it's actually suicidal what we're doing. Because the sanctions on Russia have massively backfired, and it is Western Europe which is going to suffer most from these sanctions. The Russians aren't being affected at all by these sanctions. They've sold more oil and gas this year than ever, and they've got more money for it.
What this Freedom Alliance Party lady said in reply was the Ukraine war is a conflict deliberately manufactured by the NATO allies for the purpose of creating an inflationary crisis which will further impoverish their own population.
Yes, I heard what she said, but I think in actual fact it's the US which has fomented the crisis with the help of the British.
That's what she said, manufactured by the NATO allies.
Yes, yeah. But I think they presumed that in actual fact, sanctions on Russia would hurt the Russians. And they miscalculated that completely. Just because people are evil doesn't mean they are clever. They can be evil and stupid. And what the Russians have done, militarily and politically, is checkmate the West. Because they've written off the 300 or 500 billion in Russian assets, which have been seized, and they're moving ahead. They're not relying on us anymore. And of course, in Russia, people will not be freezing this winter. We will, they won't. And it's because of the incompetence of our evil leadership that started the war in the first place in 2014 with the coup in 2014.
Is it incompetence, really?
No, I don't think that the US is sacrificing the Europeans for global hegemony. The Europeans are stupid to go along with that, but I think the calculation was that if the EU and the US put sanctions on Russia, Russia would crumble. That's turned out to be completely wrong.
Just as a background to all of this, with the Syrian conflict, we discussed quite a lot about Shamima Begum, didn't we, and the use of the intelligence services to actually get her out to fight for ISIS in Syria. This is our allies, our so-called allies at Canadian Intelligence. Well, a few weeks ago, this lady, Huda Mukbil, that's HudaMukbil, who worked for CSIS, which is the Canadian Intelligence Service, went and had a chat with ITV to say, well, actually, this sort of thing was going on, and they were using Facebook. Our intelligence services were using Facebook to recruit people for ISIS. So let's have a listen to that one now.
Process which could allow her to return home. Part of the case rests on what happened not long after she flew out with her classmates. It's now clear that at Istanbul's main bus station, they were met by a smuggler. But the man who got them into Syria was an informant working for the Canadian spy agency.
I heard of the case. I know the players. And, it was a shock.
One of its former officers is speaking publicly for the first time because she believes there was a cover-up about the role of her one-time colleagues, which she wants to be investigated. Huda Mukbil travelled the world as a senior intelligence officer and was working in the Middle East when the girls went to Syria.
I think it's important to repatriate her to the UK, her country, as well as, making sure that she has the support. I'm sure there is, it's a traumatic experience to be exploited in this way, unfortunately by a Canadian source, to be trafficked, to be exploited by ISIS fighters.
Based on her knowledge of normal procedures, she believes the agency broke its own rules, allowing the girls to be smuggled in by their source, Then they sat on those details about his involvement. The three girls arrived in Turkey on the 17th of February 2015, but Canadian intelligence learned of the role of its recruit, Mohammed El Rashid, on the 21st. He was arrested in Turkey 1 week later, but it was the following month that Canadian officials arranged to meet Scotland Yard. The Canadian service told ITV News all its activities must comply with the law and it cannot comment on investigations.
Something went wrong here, and, you know, we might not have known that the source smuggled minors, but the moment that we did, everything else after that lined up. You know, mistakes do happen, but it's what you do with it afterwards. And so not informing the Metropolitan Police was a mistake, in my opinion.
The allegations of a cover-up were first made by the author Richard Cabbage in a book which studied the relationship between the so-called Five Eyes network of intelligence agencies.
In a way, you could say that it's a laudable thing that the Canadians were able to recruit someone from inside ISIS territory when other agencies within the Five Eyes intelligence network were struggling to do so. However, in this case, there was just bad tradecraft around the recruitment, because had it been well managed, the mistake of smuggling in children into ISIS territory may not have happened.
Please find enclosed papers.
The Home Office said its decision to strip Shamima Begum of her citizenship was justified because she became a threat to national security after going to Syria. But from Canada, new questions now about how she got there. Rohit Khatru, ITV News.
Well, not really covered by the BBC much, that one. ITV broke that story, Martin, a few weeks ago. A mistake, apparently. Oopsie-daisy, we recruited some minors and they went... these are kids from East London, were trafficked over to ISIS.
Well, I think it's the tip of the iceberg. I mean, most people realise, who have studied it, that all of these ISIS people that were coming in from Turkey to fight against the Syrian government were being funneled in there by the MIT, the Turkish intelligence services, working with the Five Eyes intelligence services. Now, what's happened with Shamima Begum is that the problem they had there is they actually got caught doing it, and therefore they're now trying to cover their backsides by saying it was all an accident.
You said something went wrong. Well, that was what went wrong, wasn't it? They got caught.
Yeah, they got caught. James Le Mesurier, who committed suicide in Turkey, apparently, he's the main man behind the creation of the white helmets, which are embedded with the Al-Qaeda-based groups in Syria. I mean, we know that the Western intelligence services created Al-Qaeda in the 1980s to fight the Russians, and then supposedly they went rogue on 9/11 and attacked us. That and therefore we should learn the lesson of not supporting these kind of groups. And then in Syria, in the right up to the present day, they've been supporting exactly those same groups. The same groups are the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, who bombed Manchester. They've been working hand in glove with MI6 for years and years and years. And this has been going on and going on and going on. So what's happened in the Shamima Begum case is they don't want her to come back, because if she put on trial, all of this will come out. And of course, it's the tip of the iceberg. She was not that important. She's a relatively small fry. But of course, lots of other people were funneled in there by our intelligence services with our resources, folks. This is what your taxes go on, is to create terrorist organisations with jihadi links in order to fight in Syria and so on. But the Russian military, the Syrian military, everybody out there in the real world knows who our people are and what they do. And it's not a pretty sight. We have been encouraging both fascists in the Ukraine and jihadis in Syria, and we arm, train and direct what they do. And then we pretend that this is all happening spontaneously. It isn't. But of course, you're now up against serious opposition in terms of the armed forces of the Russian Federation, who are not going to be messed with. And you know, we're not in Kansas anymore.
One of our final investigations, I'm probably going to have to postpone till next week. This is David Halpin looking at the death of Hilda Morell. Unfortunately, it's a real shame that, because that would have been nice to hear that, because we're just running out of time, folks. And then we'll also be hearing next week from Robert Greene, who wrote this book about the assassination of Hilda Morell. I think it was called A Thorn in Their Side. And, of course, this is a pun on her being a rose grower. This is all about the state's involvement, as he believes, in the killing of someone who was giving some evidence, this woman Hilda Morell, at the Sizewell B public inquiry. Finally this week, how about something, because there's loads of stuff in the news today, actually, and late last night, about the JFK assassination. So I thought, you know, for those of us in the know, about who know what happened with the JFK, otherwise he was killed by the Central Intelligence Agency, John F. Kennedy, and by a whole bunch of right-wingers who were let down by Kennedy in the attempt to take over Cuba at the Bay of Pigs, and had been training to invade Cuba. And when Kennedy refused to give them air support and didn't seem to think it was such a brilliant idea to have a coup in Cuba run by the United States, they had quite a lot of bitterness and resentment. And the other thing is that the mafia were involved with the CIA in order to kill Kennedy. So let's have a listen now to James Files taking us through the whole business of what actually happened when Kennedy was shot, because he should know, because he shot him.
Eugene Brayton was there for a specific reason. He had the contacts inside the Dow Tech building, and he was the one that Charles Nicoletti and Johnny Roselli needed to get him into a private office somewhere or another. I have no idea where that office was. I was never in the Dow Tech building myself, so I can't even describe anything in there.
So you probably stood behind that fence there for some little time.
Only for a few. I stayed away from the fence. I stayed basically in the yard, walk over the fence, look over it, spend a minute, then walk back away again. I was observing the area.
Were you a smoker at the time?
Oh, yes, I did smoke.
Were you smoking cigarettes that morning?
I had smoked that day. Careless. I probably stepped on several cigarette butts and left in there. Most of them palm off.
Was it muddy back there?
It was very muddy. Let me put it this way. I a couple of times even took my shoes, put them up on the little concrete ledger and scraped the mud off the bottom of them.
What clothes was getting mud on. Frank Sturgis wearing?
I don't remember exactly the clothes. I remember he had on like a bomber jacket. Remember the World War II bomber jackets the pilots used to wear? He was wearing one like that. Like that, like the one you got right there. His had the brass buttons on it. Remember that. You can see that flashing, you know.
In which location of Biggie Plaza was he standing?
I was where you got the concrete steps to go down by the pergola there, and between the pergola and the stockade fence, you got a set of concrete steps to go down. I was to the right of those.
Draw me a map.
I got to put my glasses on for that.
Have you got them with you?
Yeah, but I don't want to sit here drawing. It's going to take too much time up.
Okay.
But he is to the left and just off of the sidewalk. He was standing in the grass itself.
And this was shortly before the assassination? Or?
This was just a few minutes before the motorcade got there. But like I say, before the motorcade ever arrived on scene, I took the scope off. I didn't have the gun up over the fence. I didn't want nobody to panic at that point. But I had a little scope up my hand. I could look over the fence and I could kind of check to see who it was. I was looking, like I said, I was looking for security people, you know, for somebody carrying, somebody packing. Because I want to know who's got weapons when I go to leave there.
That fence kind of makes an L shape, you know.
Yeah, it's on and off, yeah. Long it's long arrow to short arrow, but right, it's not so exactly an L, it's on a slant, 45, right. Like 45 degrees. I would say 8 to 10 feet down there. There was a tree branch that hung right over me. I was behind that, kind of giving me a little camouflage.
Okay. Did you ever see an ambulance come by?
No, I never paid no attention. I wasn't watching the vehicles that passed by. I'm looking at people. I never noticed an ambulance.
You didn't see an ambulance with red lights?
No, I heard. Might have heard a siren. I don't remember. I had all that tuned out. I'm in another complete mode. Sirens, lights flashing, ambulances, police. That don't bother me. I'm not there to look for those things. I'm there looking for other details, for other things.
Okay, so then what happened? The motorcade came?
I'm checking everything. I got most everybody. And just basically where a lot of different people are standing at. And I want to make sure that there's, like I say, I don't have any cops right next to me because, you know, something happens and I have to shoot. You know, I don't want to have to shoot anybody else unless it becomes a necessity. So I walk away from the fence. I come back over, secured everything, got it ready. I could hear the rumble, the people murmuring. So you know the motorcade's approaching. So then I got ready, opened it up. I'm holding the Remington Fireball down below the fence at this point. motorcade, come down, I believe that's Main Street there, come down on Houston, turn back around on the Elm there, and come down that little side drive there. Oh, when it come down, I made his first right, that's when I brought the weapon up. And then I'm over the fence, and as they come down, made the turn on down there, that's when I started focusing through the scope and following the car. As shots started ringing out, I started counting the shots, but I'm not counting like one, two, three, and four. I'm counting them miss, 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 because I know we're going for the headshot. So I don't care how many rounds are being fired as long as we get a headshot. But I'm hearing the shots being fired, and I'm counting them as a miss, miss. And that's the only thing I'm concerned about. I've got this sign there for the Simmons Freeway that is fixing to come into my field of fire. As far as I can see at this point, President has not been hit in the head at this time. I've seen the body lurch. I know he's been hit. How serious, I don't know. But my last instructions was we're going for headshot. If you have to take a shot, take it. But don't fire unless it's a necessity, unless you really have to. He said, Jimmy, don't fire unless you have to. We want everything from the backside. I'm not asking why. Okay, whatever you say. At this point, as it starts to approach and come behind that freeway sign, and I've already been instructed not to hit anybody but Kennedy because they didn't want Jackie getting hurt or anybody else, I'm fixing to lose my fuel of fire. And at this point, either I shoot or I can put it in a suitcase and leave, one or the other. I took the shot. I fired one shot only.
And where were you aiming?
Well, I was aiming for his right eye, which to me is the left side of his head looking head on. But for him, it would be his right eye. And once I pull the trigger, I'm right in on it. And it's almost like looking 6 feet away through the scope. As I squeezed, take off my round, his head moved forward. I missed, and I coming right along the temple, just right behind the eye.
Here in the hairline?
No. All right. Well, I'm not sure because I can't see the penetration. I know I hit him right here. I know I hit behind the eye, somewhere within a half inch diameter right there, say. But
so the two shots almost simultaneously.
You think you got hit as you were screaming?
What I believe is this, and I got my ratings as a marksman. I'm a good shooter, always was. And I'm not bragging on myself, don't get me wrong, but that's what got me my start with David Phillips because of something that I did in the service, and I made a mark there, and it's on record, and it's recorded for headshots for what I did and the things that I did. But anyway, make a long story short, as I was preparing to squeeze off my round, Kennedy's head moved forward just as I squeezed. It was already in process. The head started forward. To me, what I believe is, and I did not see, let me clear the fact now, I never saw Mr. Nicoletti shoot Kennedy, but I know he was the man in the Dow Tech building, the man supposed to be doing the shooting. Therefore, the head started forward. As far as I'm concerned, Mr. Nicoletti hit him at that point. As I squeezed off my round, the head started forward. I hit him and blew the head backwards.
So the exit wounds where in the rear?
I didn't hit the rear. The exit blew out. And you can see Jackie.
But where was the exit? On the right side or the left side?
Partially, most of it on his right side, I guess, back there, where the section come right out, part of the back of the skull. You know, I didn't go look at it. I didn't examine it. And a lot of people may find this hard to believe, but I have never read anything on the Kennedy assassination because I was never interested in it. I did not like John F. Kennedy.
Did you ever see autopsy pictures?
Did I ever see one?
The autopsy picture?
They sent me a book with it. I looked at a few of them, but I didn't read the book. I want to say the book they sent me was probably called High Treason. I never read it. I looked at a few of the pictures. I just wasn't interested.
So that's the voice of James Files. He's the ex-82nd Airborne in Korea, soldier, sharpshooter, then joined the Chicago Mafia as a hitman, and he was sent down along with Johnny Roselli and Charles Nicoletti, or Chuck Nicoletti, who he talks about there. We're up in the Dow Tech building, and he was there on the grassy knoll. He there also mentions, Martin, this guy David Attlee Phillips, who was their Central Intelligence Agency controller, he says.
Well, we've covered files before, and, you know, it's extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, everybody knows that Kennedy was assassinated by his own security forces, but if you were to ask Rishi Sunak or Keir Starmer, the former head of Director of Public Prosecutions in this country, they'd just go, oh, no, that's just conspiracy
theory.
Isn't
this Lee Harvey Oswald thing wearing a bit thin, do you think?
Well, it is for people like us.
Well, I think for a lot of people, it's just like it's the one person. We know the massive amount of evidence that he couldn't have done it.
He was a patsy. But of course, a lot of water's flowed under a lot of bridges since then. But people still, you know, it is important. I mean, in actual fact, during the lockdown, Bob Dylan released an 18-minute single called, what was it called? Murder Most Foul. It was all about the JFK assassination. And if you think that something like that can happen and nobody is held to account for it, that explains why we end up going to the Ukraine and Syria and starting wars. And then you have the House of Commons where they're all patting each other on the back about what great Democrats they all are. What a farce.
Sadly, we'll finish with this. We have to announce the death of David Ray Griffin last week. Who was he, Martin?
Well, he was a theology professor, a Baptist, but he also carved out a name for himself as one of the people who really brought to public attention all of the inconsistencies in the official story about 9/11.
No, debunking 9/11, debunking, which one of his books I seem to remember, yeah, which was the idea of, look, the debunking of 9/11, we need to debunk that too, because a lot of it is nonsense.
Yes, well, I mean, he was obviously a very key figure in the 9/11 truth movement, and he had a religious background.
He started with a book on the 9/11 Commission report itself, didn't he? Pulling it to pieces, really.
Yeah.
If you remember, Henry Kissinger was initially going to chair the 9/11 Commission.
Well, there wasn't going to be a commission at all at one stage.
Well, once they decided they wanted one, he was going to be the chair. And he just refused to hand over his list of interests. You know, so his vested interests that he has, outside interests, and he refused to hand it over. So they said, oh, well, you can't do it then. But anyway, so it's, I think, fascinating to listen to his a bit about his theology. One of his latest, the final books he wrote was all about the sort of theological side of this and the spiritual side of actually taking on one of these hideous mass lies, you know, like 9/11. Do you want to just describe the extent to which you think that the lies of 9/11 have still had an impact today, Martin?
Well, they're crucial in everything that's happened since. And we've got to understand that the people who run the West are really nasty people. They're very, very nasty indeed. They're quite capable of doing all sorts of horrible stuff. And they're very rarely held to account for it. And that is why we're in the mess we're in. Because people won't face the facts about the reality of what our state in this country and the US state and the Israeli state have become.
Well, we'll have Peter Dale Scott next week talking about him, but this week let's give it to David Ray Griffin himself, where he talks here about this is not just geopolitics, this is evil we're dealing with.
We perceive, assuming a distinction between the mind and the brain, I would say I, in the sense of my mind, I prehend my own brain. But likewise, then, I can directly prehend other souls. Many of you are aware of the evidence for telepathy, that there seems to be some sort of direct soul-to-soul relation, where we feel at a distance, the literal meaning of telepathy. But that would mean then also there would be no reason why we couldn't talk about a direct experience of God. That would be analogous to telepathy. And so this opens the way, again, to taking religious experience and moral experience seriously. Panentheism is the doctrine that our world exists in God, that all things exist in God. So it's different from pantheism, which simply says our world is God. Panentheism distinguishes between God and the world, says God is the soul of the world and in whom we live, move, and have our being. Now, panentheism was already implicit in what I said earlier about the rejection of creation ex nihilo, that God is always in relation to a world, if by a world we mean a multiplicity of finite beings, which may be in a chaotic state. Now, sometimes by world we mean one that has been brought into an ordered state, a cosmos. But in the more general sense, God exists naturally in relation to a world, and this world takes different shapes in different cosmic epochs. So panentheism is the other side of the rejection of creation ex nihilo, that God always God has created our world out of pre-existing things that pre-existed our world, not that pre-existed God. Finally, then, this doctrine says there is a divine reality for us to experience. Experientialism says that experience, like the lady's turtles, goes all the way down. Now, initially, this doctrine seems counterintuitive to us. When I first encountered it, I thought it was absolutely absurd. But now that I've become more intimate with it, I see it's just self-evidently true. Partly, think of it this way. William James had already made this argument. If we have a naturalistic universe, now James believed in God, but not a God who intervenes supernaturally, how could creatures such as us, with our experience and our spontaneity, arise out of matter understood to be completely devoid of all spontaneity or self-motion and completely devoid of all experience? How could experience arise out of non-experiencing things? Now, there are many materialist philosophers who've come around to this point of view and said, well, actually, we cannot figure out any way that can happen. So Colin McGinn, whom we had here on our campus a few years ago, said it's just an ultimate mystery we have to live with. So he was starting to sound like a traditional theologian. I mean, materialism was his religion, but he said there are just things we can't explain and we just got to learn to live with that. Why should we be able to answer all these questions? And several other materialists now have come along and say, you know, you're right. If you want an argument for a supernaturalistic God, this would actually be a very good one, because only a supernatural God could bring creatures such as us, or, you know, animal life in general, out of insentient matter. So, if you've got a non-supernaturalistic worldview, pan-experientialism, the idea that there have always been experiencing beings, not conscious beings, but with a very minimal kind of experience, that is part and parcel of the doctrine. Now, this does another thing for Christian theology or theistic religion altogether. One of the major problems of the modern world, once they developed this mechanistic view of matter, was how in the world could God be related to this world? You, in a sense, had the mind-body problem writ large. The mind-body problem being, how could a non-physical soul relate to this physical mechanistic body? Well, likewise with the universe, how could God relate to this mechanistic universe? So that was part of the basis for this move to deism and then the complete dissociation of God from the natural world that has been parcel of our ecological crisis and the fact that the churches have been so poorly equipped to deal with this because we've had a theological tradition for almost two centuries that had dissociated God from the what we call the natural world.
So that's a talk by David Ray Griffin, really much more on his theological side, Martin. But his book, The New Pearl Harbor, was one of the bestsellers of the 9/11 truth movement, wasn't it? And this reference to Pearl Harbor, very important.
Yeah, I mean, his views on theology are, you know, the sort of things you might expect a Baptist theology professor to say. But of course, he's remembered.
Well, just to be clear about his, you know, where he was in Berkeley, University of Berkeley. Griffin established something called the Center for Postmodern a Postmodern World in Santa Barbara, and became editor of the SUNY series on constructive postmodern philosophy between 1987 and 2004. So that's where he was. He was at. He was deconstructing the whole idea of postmodernism, really.
Yes, and I think all of that is of interest, because he's obviously a man of parts and wasn't just one sort of person. What I do remember when I heard him speak in London when he came over was he said, I have many non-believing friends, and they can't quite understand that the evil behind 9/11 doesn't have to have a reason. Evil is just evil because it's evil. And I thought that was a good, well-made point, is that, you know, people say, well, who would do something like that? And the answer is evil people. because they're evil. And that's actually quite a good answer.
Is that the same as people who are just purely selfish and they don't mind if people, other people suffer, die, whatever?
Well, I mean, Socrates basically thought that all bad behaviour was lack of self-knowledge, which is a very attractive idea in one way, because it means that everybody's reformable if they just, you know, have sufficient, you know, self-awareness. But it doesn't seem at all likely. You've definitely got psychopaths and sociopaths who really like inflicting suffering on other people.
Well, it's also, part of their nature. There's also the other thing, which is that once people do commit crimes, say, for example, the murder of your wife, Charles, Diana, whatever, if you've committed a crime that heinous and got away with it, then you have almost the rest of your life trying to keep your position and not to be arrested and this sort of thing. It's a horrific, I suppose, you've sent yourself into a condemned yourself, really, for the rest of your life as someone who knows they're guilty, and they've got to spend the rest of their life trying to make sure they don't get arrested and tried or rumbled for what they've done.
Yes, you've got some people who are totally unrepentant about what they've done, and I think that's probably the case in relation to a lot of the things we've been talking
about. Well, if you do repent, I suppose you're going to have to go try and face justice, but of course people, for example, involved in the assassination of Princess Diana won't want to do that.
Well, nor will the people involved in the assassination of John F. Kennedy, although it's quite interesting that Files had no interest in the politics behind it. As far as he was concerned, it was just a job.
Yes, it's, yeah, and also
I just didn't take any interest in that.
He said he likes taking out the garbage. You know, he didn't really care. He was just given the job, and he got on and did it. I suppose in a way it's similar to the SAS over in Afghanistan when he's over in Korea, becoming a sharpshooter, killing people. It acclimatized him to killing someone like Kennedy without thinking about it.
That's right. I mean, it just becomes normal, doesn't it?
That is the idea. But the new Pearl Harbor, the original Pearl Harbor was supposed to be a surprise attack. Actually, what it did is it bounced the United States into World War II, didn't it? And what we've seen, of course, with the beginning of the 21st century is the United States being bounced into this thing called the War on Terror as a result of 9/11.
Yes, and of course there is further issues around what happened at Pearl Harbor. But the idea that the state carries out these kind of major atrocities in order to create wars is actually quite straightforward. But it's so straightforward that it beggars the imagination of ordinary people who just presume that surely the people in charge can't be as evil as that. And the answer is, I'm afraid they are.
Well, they certainly can be. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also to Peter Taylor, the author of Chill, A Reassessment of the Global Warming Theories. And, of course, to Dave Bazanko, sound engineer. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Do please send me interviews and story tips, and this week, two poems, if you feel like it, via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find this podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and please don't turn the fire off, Martin, and our email addresses. You can subscribe to my weekly email list too, and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. The show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream, and also at Radio Camberley's RadioQUK.com, I believe, still on Saturdays. Do please feel free to make live recordings. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, and at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and on the glorious BCFM Politics Show app, or not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know. I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show on talkradio.org.uk. and the app at 5 o'clock next Friday. I'm going to be having a break the week after. God bless. And don't let the Illuminati banksters get you down. We'll be right back.
said the straight man to the late man, where have you been? I've been here and I've been there and I've been in between. I talk to the wind.
I've been there and I've been